You filed a flight plan to mountain rescue. If we don't report in, they'll come looking for us.
Now, that's how it's supposed to work, except I put in a flight plan for Borum Caverns, and this isn't Borum Caverns, is it, Juno?
We're in the wrong cave.
Where are we?
It hasn't got a name. It's a new system. No one's ever been down here before.
Let me ask you a question. Would you prefer to stay alive without your mommy and daddy, or die with them? That's a tough question, huh?
It was moving, it was alive, it knows we're here, we just have to go, we have to go.
We can't do that.
We didn't see it. I'm not staying here.
If we try to leave, they kill us.
We're being quarantined here! We're being kept here to die!
While you were looking for me, I was looking for you. Well, got you now.
Was that him in the car?
Yeah, sure it was. Said it walked very far.
Why is that?
Because I cut off his legs.
And I'm gonna do the same to you.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I'm one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the USA, and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going, sir?
I am well.
Excellent. How are you doing after that fall you had earlier this week?
Oh, you're going to bring that up. Yeah. I still got a bruise on my knee. It's a little sore,
damn.
But I'm alive, so...
Indeed.
Not much more brain damage than there was to begin with.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's good. Excellent. As long as you're feeding the cats, they don't care.
Right.
Yeah, that's how it is. That's how it works. We all know it. All right, sounds good. And in the state of New York.
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how's it going, sir?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
Yeah, doing all right. Can't complain. Hanging in there. And in the state of Massachusetts.
Hey, everyone. This is Abe.
Abe, how's it going, man?
I'm doing okay.
Excellent. And a Connecticut American?
Sorry. This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how's it going?
Good, except I muted myself when I meant to talk, but that's okay. I'm good.
Well, don't do that.
Right. I know, really. I got to get a handle on myself. Oh, my goodness.
It happens. So today, for folks who are interested, such as Pam, who one of our listeners, we are recording this May 7th, 2020. For folks who are curious on that besides Pam. Let's see. We do have some feedback to read, some quickies about some of our podcasts. We'll read that in a little bit. But before we get into any of that, anything of note that anybody needed to bring up, news or something that was important? Anything? Anyone?
Well, yeah, I was going to bring this up last week, but Eric was in a rush. So apparently Universal did really, really well with, what is the Trolls World Tour on streaming?
They did. No.
Really? Damn it. $100 million like the first week, and most of it goes straight to them.
Yes, yeah, about 80% instead of splitting it 50-50 with the theaters. So, apparently they're saying this is now probably going to be a strategy with their theatrical releases going forward. And there is right now a 90-day contract like window with the theaters, which says you're not going to break that 90-day window from theatrical release until you put it on streaming. And so Universal is saying they're going to break it. Warner Brothers has said they're going to be rethinking some of its theatrical approaches to it, too, now. I'm not saying that this is going to mean the end of the theatrical release, but it could be that theatrical releases are going to get more uncommon and much more expensive going down the road if they're trying to compete with this. I mean, that's just a speculation.
Well, I mean, if there is a rarity of films going to theaters, I don't expect how, they can survive because, they don't really get a whole lot of money from the movies themselves. It's mostly from concessions. So if less people are going to the theaters, I don't know how they can stay open if, so many of these big films are going to, VOD.
Well, I don't think this is intended as a short-term thing. I don't think AMC or Regal or anyone is complaining about that. And I guess AMC has basically threatened to not carry any Universal films going forward if they decide to break the window. It's the problem is when this is over, right? Once the theaters start opening, right? Because now you have some theaters in some places sort of starting to open maybe, but they have no movies to show. So really, what's the point unless they're showing streaming old classics or something like that. And I don't know a lot of people are necessarily going to go out as it is. Like when I would go to see like the Fandango events when they would show an old film, theaters were very rarely packed, So even then they didn't have a big draw. And I imagine those, the appeal for them are mostly going to be older viewers who are the most likely to be afraid to go out and die.
From what I've heard, The older folks are the ones that are getting an attitude and being like, you can't tell me to stay at all. I'll go where I want to.
No, it probably depends on the old person.
Yeah.
When I was a young one, we walked 10 miles in the snow over our
I can take care of myself.
I can handle some sort of fake virus stinking. Whatever.
Oh my goodness.
That's right.
Yeah, and I mean, and I don't want to get into that whole debate, whether it's right or wrong or too early or too soon or how. I think most people, whatever the government decides, I think I trust our listeners to be wise enough themselves to figure out how to what they can go to, what they can't go to, when they're ready, when they're not.
Exactly.
That's up to them.
When it's available.
When it is eventually available. So that's the question, right? And I also think, I admit, I don't know. I haven't seen the data. I haven't, other than what's been made public. I don't know what the internal conversations are. I do think Universal has to keep in mind that one of the reasons people were willing to pay $20 a pop for Trolls World Tour is one, I imagine a lot of parents...
Another option.
One, there's not another option. Two, I have to imagine at this point, Phil might be able to back me up on this. I don't know. A lot of parents are probably at the point of doing anything to get their kids out of their hair for 90 minutes.
Yes.
More so
yes,
than
that
usual.
That is true. That is
the
true.
The olives, yeah. Phil. The olives.
Right. Right. And olives and cheese. All right, fine. I'll get it for you.
Yeah. That's reference to to the Westworld podcast we just did. But the other thing is, I'd like to know how is Invisible Man doing and The Hunt doing and all those other movies, which Bloodshot was another one that had like a day or two in theaters and then went straight to video because they were forced to. And there are going to be people like Phil and Eric and mostly me who are going to be very, very hesitant to drop $20 to rent a movie on demand.
Right. Yes.
And you also have a much bigger risk of bootlegging, although I don't know if it can get any worse than it already is right now.
True. I mean, the chance I would spend $20 for a film is if it was the whole family type of film, right? If everybody's
right.
going to watch it. But just for me, I'm not spending no $20 just to watch A Quiet Place 2 and no one else wants to watch it and then it disappears and I can't watch it again after 28 hours.
Yeah, that's
24 hours.
And the huge appeal of A Quiet Place to me was the theatrical experience.
Yeah.
I would be much less likely to spend that kind of money on a direct-to-video sequel, even though I know it wasn't made as a direct-to-video film. And you're going to lose that experience. That doesn't mean it's going to be a bad movie.
It depends on the individual, right? Because someone like Jason Lloyd will say, the hell at the movie theater, I'm fine watching it at home. Really depends on the individual.
Jason Lloyd also gets people sending all their movies to for free, so he doesn't spend nearly as much money and has more money to spend on movies.
Right, and he also has a pretty good home theater system as well.
Right. And it depends on whether you're in a system where you have a lot of distractions, how good your setup is. There's so many things that go hand in hand with that. And yeah, it's just like I said, I'm at the point, I'm not 18 anymore or 20 anymore where I have to go see the movie on opening night. I like to see it opening weekend when I can, but you know, I don't have to. And if I'm not going and catching it in theaters, my need to see most of the movies right now, I can wait 3 months and get a rental price and not pay $20 out the nose. I don't know if my point is being, I don't know if Universal can expect the same kind of return going forward. I'm sure they're going to keep it as an option. I'm sure they're aware of these things. I don't know that they're going to do this for every film. You know, I don't know if they would do this for the next James Bond movie.
Everybody forgets that Universal is now a giant conglomerate. It's not just Universal anymore. It's Universal, NBC, and they own, you know, it's like 20 different companies, and it's one big company now, right? So if they're willing to take a chance on it, they still have all these other options that are still pulling in money for them. So they can take a chance to see, all right, let's see when it opens up, can we still just drop it straight to VOD and get people to watch it at home instead of splitting it with theaters and doing the marketing and all that other stuff, you know. So it depends on the size of the company. And Universal, I know they've been getting ripped on for having a lot of bombs recently. Again, though, they're just a division of a giant conglomerate. Comments, Mike?
Not sure that really matters in terms of their bottom line, though.
Well, that's what I'm saying, is that they're more apt to take the chance. Because it's like a mutual fund. If one stock collapses, the fund is still good because you have 20 other stocks in the mutual fund. So if Universal attempt fails, they still have 19 other companies, including their news division and their theme park division and their television division, you know, and on and on and on. So I don't know. It's just a hypothesis.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, right now, AMC is the biggest gorilla on the movie theater block, at least in the United States. And the problem is
that I think that's owned by the same AMC that is the AMC IFC TV channel and all that stuff?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so it's just coincidence that they have the same initials.
Right, is my understanding. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, but AMC is in a bad shape financially. Mm-hmm. Which we've talked about, I think, in an earlier podcast, and they don't have the if this is a pissing match, they don't have the reserves to get into a pissing match. Now maybe Disney will just say, "Fine, here, take all of our movies," and you know, Disney has accounted for most of the top 20 films of the last year. And the AMC might be able to get away with not doing Regal, Universal films, and let Regal or Cinemark or Bowtie or something do them. I don't know. It's just going to be interesting to see where this ends up long term.
Well, and that's the thing. If you live in a less rural area where there's multiple theaters, if you want to see Trolls 3 when that comes out, and let's say they play it at a theater but AMC refuses, well, that doesn't matter because I'm still going to go to that other theater because that other theater is playing the film I want to see. I don't go to a theater because of the theater. I go to the theater because of the price, the convenience, the comfort, and the film that is being played, you know. So that's the thing. If all three theaters near me play the same film, I go to the one that is the best experience. If there's three theaters and only one has Trolls 3, I'm bringing my kids to that one theater. So people are still going to go to that theater, you know.
Yeah, but a lot of people in this country don't live in places where they have a lot of theater choices. I have basically every major theater around me within 30 minutes is AMC. If I go a little further than that, I get other options.
Gotcha.
Got my local theater, which I like, I frequent often, but it is not a premium experience because they've got thin walls. So if I'm watching A Quiet Place, I'm going to hear Avengers 7 next door.
Or the Harley Davidson driving by.
Right. So...
yeah, I am very concerned about the future of AMC. We did, as I mentioned on last week's show, we did lose our little indie house called Bethel Cinema. And that's really sad because I could always go and see a good indie film there or if AMC wasn't playing it. But honestly, if AMC near me shuts down, Dude, I got nothing. I really got nothing. I'm going to have to drive an hour.
And you're in the wilds of Connecticut, you know? I mean, I know. Jesus, forget about people in Utah, or...
But your bigger mistake here is, right, I mean, back in the day that... and where I lived, there used to be a theater called Hoyt, which is, I think, an Australian company. And they closed everything down and they just moved back to Australia. So, but if AMC closes near Chrissy, someone else will either move in there or another theater will pop up as well. You know, so it's not.
Well, I do hope so. But I do know that, like, the only other theater that is within a reasonable drive for me to go see things is the one that I grew up going to in New Milford, and they have two screens. So it's whatever they're going to have. There's not going to be any variety, is what I'm saying. Like, the chances that they're going to play whatever horror movie I want to see is pretty slim.
My experience has been with the one of the major Cineplexes in the area. I've been going there since 1996, and I've always gone to the same location, but it's had three or four different names. During that time. So right. With the larger Cineplexes like that, they don't tend to close so much as change ownership.
Right. Okay.
So I wouldn't panic just yet.
Okay, yeah, that makes me feel better, because I seriously was freaking out. I'm like, I can't drive an hour to go see a movie. Like,
the problem is this theater where I am, now, they used to be in a different place and then it moved, but there's a chain history, and it used to be, I think it was USA Films theaters, and then it was Lowe's, and then it was and now it's AMC. But the reason it changed is because AMC just kept, you know, each one was consolidating, right? They were bought out, and the other theater chains stopped existing. I imagine, as we mentioned this, that when AMC, if AMC goes under, I should say, that if AMC goes under, it's going to be a lot about someone will pick up its properties. Someone will pick up and by the way, malls want theaters open, because theaters bring people. People come to the movie theater, then go get dinner or go do shopping beforehand. You know, they go buy their snacks in the Target or whatever it's in the store. So
the local bar or the local Starbucks or whatever to get a beverage before you go see the theater. Yeah.
So
my theater has a Starbucks in it.
Yeah.
There you go.
Mine has a bar.
My drive-in is opening up, May 15th. There you go. So we're going to have the drive-in experience.
That's okay for the bar in it, actually.
Yeah, a lot of places have bars now. You're absolutely right. But, I think
we've gone off the rails here.
I know.
Anyway, we can talk more about the Universal thing after we talk about the film during our news and stuff and what we've been watching. So let's get into our.
I think we've pretty much exhausted the topic.
Okay, that's fine. If you want to bring it up more after, that's fine too. But either way, let's get into our topic tonight. So Eric, what are we going to discuss tonight?
Tonight we are going to be discussing a movie that's currently available for digital rental called One. That's the number one, BR.
One BR.
Haven't you been getting my calls?
I've been busy.
When are you coming home?
I'm staying.
They put that system in a few years ago after a break-in. Don't worry. Neighborhood's a lot safer now.
I just moved here. I don't really know anyone.
What brought you to LA?
Trying to start a new life.
Missed one here. Any pets?
No.
You got it. We're neighbors. Hey, listen, we're having a barbecue. You should come.
Welcome.
We like to make this place feel like a real neighborhood.
And we all kind of take care of each other here.
Does the plumbing do that every night?
Do what?
So tired all the time. Do you hear that noise?
I don't hear anything very well anymore.
You think I'm crazy?
Run.
That's right. 1BR. Obviously, that's and reference to one bedroom. So, you know, like one bedroom apartment or how single white female, that film from a few years ago, or, well, decades
more than
ago.
A few.
Yeah, it changed that quick.
So, I was just college.
Yes, yes. This one's called 1BR, brand new film that came out last Thursday or Friday, which would have been the 1st of May, May Day. It stars Nicole Brendan Bloom in basically her first major role. I looked her up on the internet, and she actually has her a website where she still has her resume up because she hasn't done anything yet except this film, really, and she's trying to really promote herself. I'll read some of the resume later. It's kind of cute and interesting and whatnot. Giles Mathey, who's done a lot of TV, is another co-star, and then Taylor Nichols, who's another individual who's done a lot of stuff on TV as well. Taylor Nichols especially is someone that almost everybody has seen in something. And then Celeste Sully as well has done a lot of TV. So really there's no big names at all in it. It's directed by David Marmor, M-A-R-M-O-R, and also written by him. And this is his first major thing as well. He hadn't done really much except some shorts and maybe obscure episode of TV or something, but nothing else. And that's pretty much all I got for this film, except that it's getting really good reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. I think over 80-something%, and it's getting reviewed by a lot of folks, not just bloggers. So I guess we can get a go at what each of us thought about the film, how we heard about it, and things of that nature. So let's start with you, Mike.
I heard about it because you told us about it. Knew nothing about it going in, really, and watched it yesterday on streaming. And I liked it a lot. I watched it with my wife. She liked it a lot. I think this, if I'm not going to spoil it, I think if you liked a film like The Invitation a few years
exactly.
ago,
yep.
I think this one might appeal to you, although it is hitting similar themes, but also a very different movie tonally. So, yeah, I liked it a lot. I thought the performances were solid. I don't think it asked for a lot. I thought it was streamlined enough, right, that it didn't get bogged down too much in too many dark alleys that we didn't need to go to, told the story it needed to tell, and then got out of there. So I liked the story quite a bit. I'm sure there's different ways people can interpret the message depending on your particular points of view. But I highly recommend it.
All right, very good. For me, same thing. I was just going through iTunes, their top 44 films, and that one popped up, and I said it had pretty good reviews, and we saw that it was quote-unquote a cult or something, so we decided to do it, and that's why we chose it. I went in completely blind, as Mike did. Actually, I texted Eric this morning asking him if he had seen the film yet, and he said no, so I said, all right, I won't say anything, but I was going to say the exact same thing Mike said, is if you like The Invitation, you're going to like this film, Eric, but I didn't want to spoil it for Eric. It is identical to what Mike said too, which is it's very different than The Invitation, but it has the same idea. It just gets there differently. The endings especially reminded me of that film. And I agree with Mike, depending on your political views or moral views or gender views or whatever, you'll look at the film a certain way, or you'll just look at it as a pretty solid horror film and you can identify with the lead. The film is really good. I enjoyed it tremendously. I thought it was a good, quick 90-minute film. Didn't bog down. Wasn't slow anywhere. The horror actually came pretty quick, I thought, but it was really 22 minutes in when the horror began. I was like, wow, it felt the movie's really flowing through pretty quick. So it wasn't slow at all. The acting's great. I think the lead actress is pretty and has acting chops and now has this on her resume. So based off of her resume that I have here, she could break out to be someone of significance, if not a major star, at least someone of note, maybe even TV for that matter. And all the supporting cast was really good too. A couple of qualms here or there, but generally no complaints at all, and it was a really, really good film. I actually purchased it because it was only like $3 more to purchase, and I figured if it got good reviews and Rotten Tomatoes, I may want to see it again. And actually, I think my wife would want to see this too. This seems like a pretty good thriller for her, because it is actually more of a thriller than a true horror film, though those things overlap, as Mike always says. So, yeah, big thumbs up for me. Chrissy?
I keep forgetting if I'm on mute or not. I'm sorry. I really, really enjoyed this film. I watched the trailer for it, and the trailer really made me excited. And so I watched the movie today, actually, and I really enjoyed it. I mean, I was just, I guess from the trailer, I was sort of expecting sort of like a single white female or Repulsion or, you know, something that's one of these microcosmic person trapped in an apartment, impossible situation type stories. And I really enjoyed the places that the story went and took me, because it was never what I was expecting. And I just had a really good time with it. I thought the acting was good. I liked the premise of it. I really liked what it had to say about sacrificing the self for the good of the whole. I thought the themes were really strong. I liked what it had to say about family. And I really thought the setting was well done. But like I said, they kept you guessing. You weren't really sure. Like, you knew something was off, but you just weren't sure. And I just really liked it. So I'm going to give this one a high recommend. I had a really good time. Like, that's always my winner. If I had fun, then it was good. And I really had fun, and I did not expect to have fun watching this.
It is a little weird to say that, isn't it?
It is. It is weird to say you had fun, but you know what? Especially with a horror movie, or if it's got gore or whatever. But I think what we really mean when we say we had fun is that we kind of really immersed ourselves, right? And we immersed ourselves, and
remember that one?
Yes, I love The Gift, but we immersed ourselves and we got away from the real world. Like, some films I'll watch, and I'll be very distracted by, like, oh, thinking about this or thinking about that, or, oh, I got to go to the store, whatever, you know, sometimes things pop in your head depending on, you know, where you're at, or, pardon me, if the movie grabs you or not. And this thing grabbed me and would not let me go. Like, I felt like I had completely turned my brain off for an hour and a half. Like, I was not thinking of anything else except what was going on in that movie. And so for me personally, when I say I had fun, that's usually what I mean. Like, I just went somewhere else and, like, totally disappeared, was not thinking about anything going on in my life or the world. Which is even more interesting because I was actually at work while I was watching this. So I was so engrossed in it that I know I answered the phone and I know I was transferring calls, but, like, I really probably was so engrossed in the film that I was just like, okay, and doing what I needed to do almost by rote. So it was awesome. I really, really liked this film. So thank you for recommending it, Phil.
Yep, very good. And for folks who are curious, Chrissy was doing it during her lunch hour. Otherwise, she was working full time and very hard.
Yeah. Okay, Phil. Thanks.
As we know, with our millions of listeners, the odds are very good when Chrissy's coworkers are tuning in.
Yes.
Indeed.
Yeah. That would be like none of them. They're all a bunch of scaredy cats. They all hate horror, so nobody's going to be listening to this.
Fair enough.
They're the romantic comedy crowd. What can I say?
You know, nothing right. There's some good films there.
Well, this is kind of romantic.
Anyway, let's go with Abe. What do you got, Abe?
So for me, I heard about this film because, it was the next film that was supposed to be on our to-do list for topics. I watched it this late afternoon to make sure I kept remembering as much as I could, keep it fresh in my mind. as I usually do. The film was really well made. I thought it was, you know, for a small budget film, I thought it was well shot. The cast did a fantastic job, especially Nicole Bloom, who really, I felt, carried the film, considering that while there is a number of characters, there's a smaller focus on them than there is on her. And I felt that she did a really great job of showing the struggles, both emotional and physical, in the face of this what she's entrapped in, without spoiling anything. It's not exactly a film I would say I had fun with watching, but I felt it was one that was well paced. And there were a couple of key scenes that I felt were really really stood out in comparison to everything else. But I think it's a film I would only really ever want to watch once. There's not a whole lot for me. I would find rewatch value. And I felt for the cultist angle in terms of what it is, it's certainly a pretty grounded one. But if you're looking for one that stands out a little more, there's other cultist films. I mean, Midsommar, for example, really goes for a wild direction with the cult angle. This one's pretty, as I said, it's more grounded and more towards a little less wild, but it's also kind of, I feel, can get lost in there with the other films in that subgenre. But it's not a bad film at all. As I said, it's just one I think is going to appeal. This appeal is going to vary from person to person, especially whether regardless of it's in the subgenre of cult films or just in. I would definitely call this more of a thriller than a horror. But it's an interesting watch, and I think there is a lot to dissect from it, especially the themes and topics it presents to its audience. I think it interesting how it is almost like a roller coaster slowly building up before it brings you a huge drop at the finale. I think it really executes that finale pretty well. I think there is a vivid twist, and how that resonates with the audience is, as I said, is going to vary in terms of how it is fulfilling. I'll pull you in, but it's a decent watch, you know, if you have Amazon, available at hand, it's worth a watch.
All right, very good. What about you, Eric?
I think I actually heard about this first on the WotC Horror Party Show. They go over new releases every month, and I think they mentioned this along the way. But I really didn't know anything about it going in other than the title. So I think I was a little bit taken off guard by what I was presented with, and it took me a second to regain my footing. There are some things in this movie that I would classify as torture, and I don't groove on that a whole lot. It upsets me. But putting that aside, I would say that this is a very good movie. And I agree with a lot of what Phil said, particularly in that the ending totally reminded me of The Invitation. I think everybody in the movie was quite good. The lead actress, she is very good. However, she looks very young, and that's part of what was upsetting me about the whole thing. I was just I was not emotionally prepared for what I was presented with. So I was like, yikes. So I may actually give this another watch just to kind of have myself braced for it when it happens. But I do think this is a very good film, and if you're into that kind of thing, the whole cult angle, then you should check it out.
All right, very good. Yeah, I just twittered David Marmore and Nicole Bryden Bloom to see if they would want to come on the podcast and maybe talk to us sometime in the next weeks or two, because David only has 46 followers and Nicole only has 140 followers. So they'll probably get the message. So it'll be curious to see if we get a response from them. But either way, we're going to talk about their film tonight. And it seems like everybody at least thought it was a well-done film and well-acted and written and all that. It's really comes down to your taste. And I know me, Mike, and Chrissy, for sure, I think it was one of the top horror films that we've seen this year anyway. All right, so what's
this one is going to be in near my top. I do want to, because I'm always very careful about expectations for listeners, since we did compare it to the invitation, if I remember correctly, for 2015, maybe 2016, that was like my number one or two film for that year, and it is still a film that? That I
oh, the invitation.
Yeah, that's a great... right, and it's still a film when someone's like asks what's a movie you'd recommend from like the last 10 years or so, The Invitation is like one of my first three films I'd mention if I'm looking for something that was not a theatrical release. I wouldn't put it up in that category. It has got certainly tonal similarities. You could say similarities, something like, what's the movie? Stepford Wives. Is another one that it has some similarities to. I don't think it's as good, but it is still very good.
Right. Yeah. Very good, very good. Now, Eric, we have a wiki, is it?
Wiki.
All right. Not much to this one. Sarah tries to start anew in L.A., but her neighbors are not what they seem. That's it.
All right, that sounds pretty good. Yeah, that's good. That's good. It still tells you too much, though, right? It tells you too much when you think about it.
Well, no, they make the neighbors seem shady pretty quick, so.
Or at least eccentric, yeah. And since we're in a horror film, you pretty much know that.
Something's going to be wrong.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. The eccentricities in a regular film, we would just think they're eccentrics, but or flaky. But in a horror film, when they're eccentric or flaky, we know that they're for no good. So that's
yeah, I think in hindsight it gives something away. I think if I had not watched the film already, and I was watching this film for the first time, and I knew that that's what the story was, there's a red herring in Lance, the eye patch guy.
Yeah.
You know where I would have been expecting it to be, you know, some sort of stalker kind of.
It's actually
guy
it's Lester.
Lester. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. I know it began with an L.
Yeah.
So that would have been my take. So I don't even think it spoils it that much, because I think it's leading you to think one thing and then it ends up being something completely different. I don't think somebody watching it the first time, you know, with that description is going to be thinking, oh, they're an evil cult.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I liked about it. I really was not expecting the cult aspect. I think what I was suspecting from the trailer was something more along the lines of like, I don't know, like maybe like a Rosemary's Baby or
that's what you get for watching trailers.
Yeah, I know. Or but that's I think in this case. The trailer, the fact that I watched the trailer actually did me a service, because I went in expecting one thing that I was already kind of excited about, and I got something different that I actually liked even better. So I think in this one rare shot, it actually worked for me a little bit. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Very well. Very well. Speaking of the Rosemary's Baby. Obviously, that's a cult film too, but yeah, it was a little different for sure. All right, so before we get into spoilers and critique and symbolism and all that other wonderful stuff, I guess we can talk about anything related to the film itself that's not spoilery. I do have Nicole Bryden Bloom's resume right from her website.
I'm staring at it right now too.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
There is nothing. I just want everybody to know there's nothing remotely creepy about any of this.
well, when this is what I do. When we do our episodes, we basically
this is the purpose of the website, Mike.
Yeah, it's the purpose of the website to promote her. And also, when we do this, we always look to see other things that the actors, the writers, the producers, the directors have done before. And since they had nothing, really, the only thing that popped up was her website. And she's looking for I guess, animation work as well, to do voices, because she can do the chipmunk voice. So she says dialects are proper British, Irish, Southern, like NC and Alabama. She's from North Carolina, I believe, anyway. So it wouldn't surprise me if she does have a Southern accent. The chipmunk voice she can do. And she's done a lot of some theater, regional theater in North Carolina area, I assume. Elon University, which is in North Carolina. And done some TV work as the guest star of the week in Law and Order, SVU, and the Michael J. Fox show, and things of that nature, and a couple of shorts. And a BFA in acting at Elon University. And
I hope to see her in more stuff.
I do too. Yeah, she's really good. And
there's a good scene where she's a scene with her between her and her father, where she has to sell a couple of layers worth of emotions at the same time.
Yeah.
It was pretty good.
And I think that she did that very well. I think there's interviews throughout between her and her captors. And she has to basically give the same response to a question a couple of times. But again, the emotion behind it has to be different.
Mm-hmm.
I think she does a really good job of selling that too.
She actually played Belle in Beauty and the Beast at Regional Theater. She's 5'6", 115 pounds.
You're just going to go through this whole resume, and there's nothing we can do to stop you.
He'll stop when he gets to the cup.
His last part is pretty good, which is – what did he say? What did Mike say? The last thing is she has a mezzo-soprano and can sing F3 to A5, so that's pretty good. So she got a lot of talents. Okay.
Every move you make, every vow you break. I'll be watching you.
What is going on?
Dude,
one thing I wanted to mention before we get into spoilers is that one thing I noticed instantly right at the beginning of the movie was the music.
Yes.
I thought the score for this movie was quite good.
Yes. I did too. That was the first note I made was, oh my gosh, I love this theme. I think what I liked about it was that it was mournful, but it was also beautiful. And they did some interesting things, Eric. I don't know. Would you call that atonal? Music more
a little
better than I do. Yeah. But it worked. It wasn't like, you know how sometimes you get like a horror score and it's atonal stuff and it's just like, oh my God, I can't even, like, this is actually pretty. I would buy this soundtrack and play it. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought it was really beautiful. That was the first thing I noticed as well.
Yeah, the music's by someone named Ronan Landa. And Ronan Landa, that's a man's name, spelled R-O-N-E-N, not the regular Rowan. And he's done a number of horror films, to be honest. He's done At the Devil's Door, The Pact. So The Pact, that was one that a lot of people liked. Devil's Door, I think, got a Scream Factory release or something like that. So he's done a lot of films of note. Writer of songs. Yeah. What's that, Mike?
One thing that's very interesting, too, is the way it's shot. There's a lot of sterile colors used. A lot of whites and stuff like that to kind of show a very like clean and almost quote unquote pure atmosphere, which very really reflects what the cult is going for, a very untainted sort of mentality and presence for all its members. You know, this world that has no kind of blemishes or anything like that because of white walls. The place itself, you know, even if it's an apartment, it's very clean, there's very little sense of grit, and everything's in proper order. And so it gives you that sense of how it feels almost like it kind of goes back, I guess, almost like a lab, a sterile lab where everyone's the experiment is being put into place to test out each new candidate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, at least the main hallways and the empty apartments. When you go out into the courtyard, that's pretty nice. And everybody's internal apartments that we see, the handful that we do see, are very nice, too.
Yeah, but I'm saying that they lack any sense of individuality. They feel very ticky-tacky. They feel almost the same because the very fact that they replace candidates like through a revolving door almost like repairing a cog in their machine. You know.
Yeah, I think the cleanliness serves a couple of purposes. One, of course, is you have to believe that this is a place that people would be, pardon the saying, so would be dying to get into. Right, that would be very attractive to people in the Los Angeles area looking for an apartment.
Yep.
And so it has to look kind of clean and normal. You don't want it dirty and run down, and you don't want it looking like a hippie commune either. Right. That, you know, where you got a lot of, you know, artists and something with a more bohemian lifestyle. But at the same time, it's then, I think, to demonstrate this sort of sterility of the culture of the cult, right? That total lack of self and individuality.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are a bunch of different professions. You know, we meet a lawyer, a top lawyer, a top doctor. Obviously, the supervisor of the complex. You know, he's jack of all trades type. We have younger folks. We have older folks, and retired actress, a young guy that we're not quite sure what he does or whatnot. And then we have there's one eccentric guy that has an eye patch, and he's the only one that looks, I guess, like wrong, out of place. But the rest all seem like their individuality, even though they all look different ages, different makeups. They all have the same happy-go-lucky attitude. You're going to say something, Chrissy.
Oh, I was just going to say there was a moment in the film where, you know, the guy invites her to his, like, evening dinner party or whatever, and everybody in this complex is just sitting around, and it's the middle of the day, and I'm like, don't these people work? Like, there was, like, a moment where I was just like, this is weird. Like, I already knew something weird was going on, but I think that was my biggest clue right there. I was like, why aren't people at work?
Yeah, it didn't bother me, Chrissy, and I'll tell you why. Is because when we were introduced to the people, we were said, okay, this person's a doctor, this person's a lawyer. You know, so right away, I felt, okay, they work, and they just didn't bother showing the people at work. But
do we want to throw up a spoiler flag?
Yeah,
because it seems like we're getting into it.
Yeah, all right. Well,
I would say that
about anything and everything. And if you haven't seen the film yet, it could be spoiled. Go ahead, Mike. What are you gonna say?
I would say the doctor and the lawyer were sort of a warning flag to me, because how many doctors and lawyers as a couple do you know of that are going to be living in the same apartment complex as a young out of work actress? You know, or a temp with a temp
job. She wasn't an actress. She wasn't doing an actress.
Oh no, someone with a temp job and an old actress, who, you know, retired actress with, you know, from a B movie queen or whatever she was. I mean, you're not. Now, I understand that rent may be an issue in Los Angeles, as it is here in New York. I think that a doctor and lawyer living together could support something better.
As really successful.
Well, there's one thing.
I wasn't necessarily making that point to say it bothered me. It just stuck out to me that something was off about this community because nobody was really at work. That was all I meant.
What's interesting, though, is that even though people have these occupations and stuff, we never see them at their jobs, but also it kind of shows how the very fact that how easily they blend in with one another. You know, the mentions of the occupations is kind of offhandedly brought up. It never plays any role. So we just kind of, so everybody feels like the same kind of present in a way, except for the leader of that section. Everybody else kind of feels interchangeable, which kind of shows how easily they replace or dispose of members when they have run out of their use.
Right. Well, and I did agree with Mike, too. I felt it was weird that you had a doctor and a lawyer in a one-bedroom apartment type of community when, yeah, I was thinking the same thing, Mike, that they would be living up on Beverly Hills or where the Manson murders happen, where, you know, where all the fancy houses are. So,
right. I thought, it didn't even have to be there, but I mean, even if they had, I imagine they probably had one and two bedroom apartments. They just wouldn't be in that complex. I just didn't see it. But in hindsight, it also makes sense because, obviously that community would need a doctor. Obviously that community would from time to time need an attorney. So they still had roles to fill.
Right. Right.
Yes, because yep. There was a specific comment in there, too, about, well, you know, we called you here because we needed you. You're going to fulfill a role, you know, whatever that role is. But I think this also, you know, the fact that she had stars in her eyes about being a Hollywood costumer really was interesting to me because it was really about how, you know, she really never found herself. Like, she grew up in this home. There was this tragedy in her past, which I thought was very well played out. It just, you know, we sort of find out as it goes, and it's not made a central focus. It's just kind of casually mentioned a couple of times, and that worked for me. But she never really figured out who she was. So I thought it was interesting that her passion in life was to make costumes.
And like, to yeah, that's interesting because, you know, with costumes, it's the part of creating skins, these visages for roles and
right.
And so it kind of almost feels cinematic in the sense that now I can costume for her by converting her to this cult. They're giving her a role.
Yep. Yeah, I really thought that was well done. And I mean, I think there were a lot of interesting things in this movie to talk about. I certainly don't think it's, you know, the meatiest movie in the world, but I did think there was some really interesting subtextual stuff going on here, too. And that was kind of nice because that makes those sort of movies richer, you know?
Sure, sure. Well, and that's what Mike was mentioning, is that there may be no subtext at all in the film, but depending on your worldview will determine whether or not you see a subtext within the film, to be honest. So it depends on that, I think, more than anything. I think that's what you meant, right, Mike? Because that's what I felt.
Yeah, and you're going to see this depending on your particular point of view. It certainly is an argument for individuality and for freedom. You know, I would argue, you know, that, you know, it could be a criticism of the communist point of view, you know, literally the original definition of the term from coming from, you know, community and communism, putting community first, you know, and this is the problem that you have is that in order any communist society, eventually the only way it can work is by crushing the people under its heel and getting them to conform. So that's where my particular point of view tends to come from this, but I can certainly see others who look at it a different way. Anyway, so that's me.
Sure, sure. Yeah,
It wasn't preachy about this is how, and I also know people in looking at it afterwards who, you know, pointed to this as, you know, talking about things like Scientology, which I know they have that series. My wife has watched it. I haven't. I really have very little interest in it.
It's quite good.
And certainly, I guess, I'm sure it is. It's just not my interest. So yeah, depending on what your exposure is, what your priors are, as I've been hearing people use that a lot lately, you know, what your prior preconceived notions are, this can really be interpreted in any way, and it doesn't hit you over the head with anything, I don't think.
You're right, and I would agree with that. And I just want to let all listeners know that we do not have any bad things to say about Scientology. We don't know anything about the religion and those who follow it. You know, and you're happy with
yourself,
it. That's good. But,
Eric has watched the miniseries. He can talk about it. I don't have a personal problem
well,
with Tom.
Well, that's the thing is that you can watch a miniseries on anything. And if someone's against that thing, it's going to be slanted that way. And I'm just saying,
use the word you, not we. That's all. I'm just saying, don't put words in my mouth. That's all.
I'm just saying, screw Scientology. I welcome our robot overlords.
All right, let me rephrase it. The podcast does not endorse any negative things about Scientology. It's not our business. Personally, each individual representative of the podcast can believe whatever they want.
There we go. That's all I was looking for.
Right, that's right. I see you're saying. I saw other things too. I did not read any reviews to see what other reviewers felt the movie means, like a lot of people do. The only review I did read was a little, I think, the RogerEbert.com website. But basically, I saw maybe woman rights, possibly if you look at the worldview that way. I saw the communist thing as or fascist thing, as Mike mentioned. I saw the conformity of communes. So it was an interesting thing. And then I just saw it as also just a bunch of kooks, and you could argue that that's what it is.
And I didn't have a chance to do any research either, because I had to wait until after my shift was over today to watch the movie. So I was wondering, does anybody know if the book they're throwing around during this movie is a real book?
I never looked. What was it up.
I didn't bother looking it up. That's a good question. I can't believe it is.
Grounds for libel if you did that.
Yeah.
Or slander or whatever the legal term for that would be. I did write it down.
I mean,
the power of community.
Okay. Right. So obviously you could argue that it is kind of a play on Scientology because L. Ron Hubbard wrote Dianostics and that was being passed. Dianetics, sorry. And so technically the idea could be directed by that, because there's they're talking about the writer of the book and how he passed away, and yet they're still going on strong, mm-hmm. because you don't need the leader even though he's passed, because it comes from the leader, it's not the leader. So you're right, Mike, the Scientology, or Eric, you, whoever brought it up, it could be portrayed as a commentary on even on Scientology. Again, we don't know much about the director and what he was trying to get at, but
I didn't have Scientology come into my head during the movie. I did have communism come into my head during the movie, so that was just how it hit me.
I mean, I saw a lot of 1984 and Animal Farm from George Orwell in this too, so it is a film that, and many documentaries. You said you saw the Scientology one. I've seen, the Jim Jones ones and stuff. So, yeah, I mean, it is interesting, is all I can say. But you know what? The thing is different, though, because this one here, the people weren't willingly joining it, right? Well, technically, in Scientology and various other religions or groups or organizations, people join willingly, right? Here, this is nothing to do with.
Yeah, they were forcibly conditioned into those roles.
Yeah.
It was kidnapping, right?
She joined the community willingly, not knowing what she was getting into, which is often the case with things like this. And then once she was stuck in it, they wouldn't let her go.
Right.
So you look at the Jim Jones thing. Yeah, people would join Jim Jones, his flock, and they would may have gone to Jonestown. But when people wanted to leave, that's when problems came in.
Mm-hmm. Right,
and that's the same thing happened here.
Mentioned that. I'm sorry, I just need to get this out before I forget. Phil mentioned that in the reviews he was reading that they were bringing up the women's rights, and honestly, that was something that came up for me in the beginning of the movie, because it was interesting. I had to have a fight between my heart and my brain on this, because I found it very upsetting to see all these bad things happening to this young woman on screen, and I was thinking, man, this is misogynistic. But then, I'm thinking to myself, well, but they did it to these dudes that are here too. So it's not really, we're just seeing the most recent one as a woman. So is it really? So like that exchange was going on in my head while I was watching this movie.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right, Eric, because we find out that everybody in the community had to go through the same thing, no matter their gender. Some of them made it out horribly, like Lester, where they poked his eye out.
Oh, Lester.
And stuff. So and who knows how many people they killed that they couldn't confirm.
Never got into that.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Not to mention how many pets they probably killed.
Oh, those fucking bastards! Ah, I've never seen anybody bake a cat before. That was
that was awesome though. Only because I have never seen it done. And I was
cats, thank God, were both asleep when that happened, so I didn't have to cover their eyes.
Well, and you know what's funny about this whole thing is that, all right, I haven't had to deal with a situation where you are tortured to the point of becoming Stockholm syndrome or just fatigue where you just give up and you become a zombie. But I'll tell you this, if they did that to my dog, Lily, and I'm sure everybody would say that about their own pet, at some point, you're always going to remember what they did to your loved one, because your animal is a loved one. Hmm. You're going to kill those motherfuckers.
Oh, damn right? Fucking straight. Damn fucking straight.
You know, so if they did that to Lily, believe me, I would be trying to figure out how I could
pass my detective. If anybody bakes my cat, I'll be the last thing they see.
Yeah, so I would try to figure out how I could pass the lie detector test so they will let me alone, and then I would be planting my revenge and kill them all.
Well, I think
the whole fucking place down.
I think one of the things here is why the patriarchy and so forth isn't the first thing I thought of. You certainly get hints of it with the fact that she's dealing, like you say, you're looking for another daddy, right? She has daddy issues. The fact that most of her torture is done by the two men, the fact that she is I know she's 5'6", but she is still fairly petite. You know, so she's a little bit taller than average for a woman, I believe, but you know, she's not exactly someone that an average size
man.
She's
not like Lisa, her friend.
Yeah, right.
Right. Lisa,
and all sorts of things that would hit if you look at some of the stuff that's been talked about among feminists now is stuff like being afraid to assert yourself in your place of work. There are themes of that here. It is not exclusively that. I think they touch on some of it. And again, they touch on some of those chords because those will appeal to some people.
I do like how they had her boss be a woman. Actually, the owner of the company was a woman, and that was her boss. And so that took away some of that argument for me, because
some of it, but it's more about societal conditioning than specifically just man woman relationships. What was her role? Her role was basically her role in the community was basically to be Lester's bride, right? And presumably, you know, they spent a couple of times focusing on children. On the pregnant woman, she was kind of there to be an incubator, and I certainly, you know, Pam, despite the fact, you know, that she teaches elementary school, does have a child issue, so she certainly reacted when she realized what they wanted her for. I totally see that aspect of it, and if you're that, and I can see a lot of women reacting to that differently than most guys are going to. It doesn't mean that it is all that it was about. Because, yes, it is something that's being visited upon everybody. It's just in different ways. And I imagine if you told this story, if you told this Lester story, it would have been done differently.
Mm-hmm.
They probably would have treated her differently because there are differences between men and women. It's also going to be a lot harder to physically intimidate a grown man of average size or larger than it is to do it to a young woman. Again, it all would have been handled in a different way.
Well, the other thing I thought that was kind of interesting while we're talking about the female aspect of this, or some feminine you know, issues related to women. I thought it was really interesting in that she moves in, she meets this cute guy, right? And in a typical thriller, you would see her maybe being happy that some cute guy is showing an interest in her. And yet, even though, yes, initially it's because she's hiding the cat, right? But then he invites her to the dinner, and I thought it was so interesting that she forgot about his invitation. Like,
well, she turned it down.
She turned it down initially, but then said, okay, I'll come, or whatever. But I mean, the thing was, is that she didn't act like your typical heroine would act in a horror movie where they're like, oh, the cute guy's paying attention to me. Like, they just didn't go that route. And I thought that was interesting, like in the film as a whole, because think about it. Like, you always have, most of the time in these heroines, you know, they move in and, oh, there's a cute guy. You know what I mean? And this time they did not go that way. And I just wanted to bring that up. I made a note of it, actually, because I thought that was just interesting. Again, it was another place where this movie surprised me in really cool ways.
Right. Yeah, because she did like the guy, and you figured if this was a normal world and not a horror film, eventually she probably would have gone on a date with him, because she obviously had attraction. You know, when she's talking to the cat, she goes, you're ruining my love life.
Yeah.
Hang out with the guy for a little bit. So eventually, but you're right. It also showed that she had other things on her mind, that she wasn't, you know, just pining over this one individual. Or it could have just been immaturity too, you know. But either way, you're right. It makes it much different than the typical thing where she would have fell for the trap because of the nice guy, and then the guy turns out to be the bad guy. Which turns out that's what happens, but it didn't go as planned for him, because she was more interested at that night to hang out with her girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it also just kind of plays around with, if you kind of go into the film blind, you expect him to be the main antagonist, but he's just ends up being another cog in the bigger scheme of things.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, and even when he invites her to dinner, and she turns him down, it's because she's thinking of the bad day at work, thinking of her deal with her father. And various other things, and generally, we haven't talked about the father yet. But her and her father were really close. I mean, she was the daddy's little girl type of thing, and she obviously, based off of what she talked about to her friend Lisa, you know, she had a really good relationship with her father. But when her mother started getting ill, we don't know what the disease was. And she became bedridden to the point where she couldn't do anything except stay in bed all the time. So I'm assuming it was almost like what's that, Mike? Eric?
I was just going to say, I'm pretty sure they did mention cancer.
Okay.
Yeah, so, they did. Yeah.
So if you know, when you're stuck in bed and whatnot, we've seen some famous people like John Edwards and Newt Gingrich and a few other people. Then go and they start dating some other woman on the side, even though the wife is in the hospital or in bedridden. And eventually, I guess that would be fine after the passing. But when this happened while the mother was still alive, the daughter, obviously, Sarah, our main character, relationship with her father kind of fizzled out a little bit. And the thing is, to make it even worse, was her mother's nurse was the one that he was having an affair with. So it's unfortunate. And so it's a one way anger, because obviously the father still loves his daughter tremendously and would do anything for her. She obviously is very upset because the loyalty of the mother being ill and the father having a relationship outside of the marriage during the illness. Fortunately, the mother never knew about it. And when she passed away, you know, still happily married with her husband. I'm guessing that the husband probably would have never had the affair in the first place if the mother hadn't become ill and bedridden anyway. But
unfortunately, he chose the wrong way to
yeah,
do it.
Yeah, but this is like the teacher I know who got fired because he was having an affair with a girl who was a senior. You know, if it really matters to you, you could do whatever you want. You just have to wait a couple of months.
Right. Yeah, and exactly.
I'm sure he would say he would do anything for his daughter, but he would also put his daughter in a terrible position by having this affair in the first place.
Yeah.
And then continuing it and then marrying the woman after, you know, she died. So, yeah, he could say he would do anything for her, but, you know.
Oh, I have to disagree.
Anything convenient.
I agree that what he did was horrible. However, I don't think what he did changed his opinion of what he would do for his daughter. Obviously,
you're talking about what his opinion of what he would do for his daughter. I didn't disagree with that. I'm talking about what he would actually do for his daughter and he clearly has limits as to what he would actually do for his daughter. There are times he puts his needs ahead of hers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all right, I can see that. I can see what you're saying. Though I don't know what he was thinking. I mean, obviously, dating in his eyes by having an affair with this woman, I don't think he thought that he was still wouldn't do anything for his daughter. So I think it's a little different than him like abandoning the house family and never seeing his daughter again, like we usually hear what happens. This is unfortunately between him and his wife, but affects her terribly, meaning the daughter. So and so she's the one that's going to hold it against him, but I don't think he would not do anything for her still. So I have to disagree,
would,
I guess.
No. You're talking about what he would think he would do as opposed to what he would do.
But
that's my argument.
You're implying that he wouldn't do is what I'm asking.
Give
I'm
up confused. The girlfriend, not fuck the nurse right. while she's taking care of the mother.
Yeah.
Right. Here's that. That's right. But again,
not come clean with the wife and make his daughter hide this secret.
Yeah, I agree. I guess I see what you're saying. I was talking about just whatever the word is. Unconditional love for his daughter. I think he still had that whether or not he was a dink.
Oh yeah, he doesn't feel any differently about his daughter, but he's not going to let it get in the way of what he wants to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. I agree with you that. Yeah, exactly. Yep. No, that's true. He was going to still have the affair with this woman, even if his daughter told him, don't do it.
Yeah. And
exactly.
That was one of the really strong scenes. One of the strongest scenes I felt was that moment where she had to drive him away in order to stop the cult from killing him because they try to initiate somebody into their ranks. They try to make sure they cut all ties for their own life, and if anyone tried to get involved in there, they had to kill them in order to uphold one of their virtues, which is their security. And so she has to literally just outright, mostly destroy her own father to keep him away from the cult, because the pretty boy was in the other room waiting to kill him if he got too close.
Yeah, exactly. So part of this this commune, cult, whatever you want to call it, is you have to cut off all ties to your previous life. Mm-hmm. And the thing that makes this cult very evil, besides the fact they kidnap you, is they have no qualms about killing people if they are an issue with what they think is the livelihood of their cult.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the whole significance of the nails. The nails yep. through the hand.
Okay, go for it.
Yeah, very much obviously a crucifixion reference. So,
you think?
Yeah. But what I kind of liked about it was it was about really the sacrificing of the self for the good of the whole, which of course is Christ-like. So essentially they were sort of viewing themselves as Christ figures. And normally you could say, okay, they're playing God, which I don't know if I really think the playing God thing fits. I think it's more about you know, the whole idea of self-sacrifice for the good of the many, which is, you know, Eric or one of you said was thinking communism. That had kind of popped into my head as well when I was watching this once or twice. I don't know if that's the comment that was actually being made. I just know that that's what struck me about the communism. But then in the end, of course, it comes back around. And Lester actually sacrifices himself for her. So I thought that was very interesting, the way that played out.
The difference is he sacrificed himself for her. He didn't sacrifice himself for them. He sacrificed he himself made an individual choice to sacrifice himself for another individual, as opposed to just surrendering the his whole life for community.
I really like that turn too. I wasn't expecting it.
Yeah,
yeah.
I was not either. I thought that was absolutely fantastic. And then of course, Lester, who you've sort of felt a little bit creepy about this whole movie, in that one moment, he really does redeem himself. You're like, oh my God, I like this guy. Now I feel
Lester
bad.
Lester, in general, they totally mess with your mind when it comes to Lester, because you're
really
only
thinking
he's a creepazoid for the whole movie. And then there's even that one scene where you think he's trying to get her to come in the bedroom to have sex with him. And then they interrupt. Somebody comes in and interrupts because her dad shows up, and they have to have that interaction. But then later, you find out that he wasn't actually trying to have sex with her. He was just going to show her the sewing machine.
Yeah.
Right.
And I thought that was one of the most genuine human moments in this very sterile place, because everyone's interactions with each other is very stiff, almost robotic-like. And this moment, that moment and also the moment between her and the father, were the more human moments. Things that the cult are intimidated by, because it goes against their so-called selfless virtue. You know, you're supposed to give up your own happiness for the sake of the community.
You're right. And also, Lester, too, he was probably holding a grudge against the cult probably the entire time. It's just that when he was, I guess, programmed or Stockholm or whatever, he had a horrible experience where they ripped his eye out, and they obviously did the crucifixion thing to him, and who knows what else they did to him.
Made him watch the gallows.
right. The Evil Dead remake, and so that Dave had a maze. Oh my God, that was terrible. But either way, he kind of broke, and then when she showed up, that was when he kind of was getting to be deprogrammed. He was deprogramming himself, I think, and especially when she and Lisa try to escape. That's when I think he fully was on board with saying F this and whatnot. Because some people, it's easy to deprogram, and others, they are completely into it. Like the doctor, she was all into it 100%. She was pretty bad. And then there's some that are just defeatists and are just there like zombies. And I think that's what he was until he was able to reawake, I guess, is the word I'm looking for.
And I'd like to say that I just think that I don't necessarily think that the approach taken by this group in this movie would be effective necessarily. Because most of the time when you have somebody in a cult, and they never say it's a cult in this movie. That's the word we're using, just to put that out there. But in a situation like this, generally people are indoctrinated, right? They're introduced to the idea and get pulled in and kind of brainwashed to be part of the group. Whereas this one, they just kind of select people and for all intents and purposes, kidnap them and torture them until they come around.
Or they don't, and then they just dispose of them by killing them.
Right, and I think you'd end up with more Lesters than not.
Yeah. I think part of the thing is, though, that it depends on the person. We saw several people who had the nail marks in their hand. Mm-hmm. You know, but they do mention that, you know, they were hoping, like, she missed the dinner party. She turned down the dinner party. Maybe things would have gone differently if she had turned down the dinner, if she hadn't turned down the dinner party. They may have a soft sell as well as a hard sell. Right. Obviously it went that way with Lisa, but Lisa was also a little bit more headstrong. There may be others who just kind of get taken in, you know, through much less aggressive means. We just didn't get a chance.
I didn't get that impression.
I mean,
let me say this: is that they know, everybody knows who this the original leader and the guy that wrote the book is, right? So he's, if not a household name, he's someone that people just would know. Some people, you know, like not everybody knows who L. Ron Hubbard is, or William Faulkner, or J.D. Salinger, or Dolly Parton, but enough people do that. You know, people know who he is in conversation.
There
so
was quite the selection of names, by the way.
Yes, I was trying to make it not all cult and very eclectic. I was trying to be very eclectic.
You succeeded.
Yes, yes. And so the thing is some people may just join freely because they read the book and they go, oh, I love this group. I love this guy. You know, similar to any organization. While some, and that's why I think Mike is right, there probably was a hard sell and a soft sell. But you're going to say something, Abe.
It's just, you know, this whole, it's, you know, for this one community to try to get such a because their plan is to spread outwards. They're not planning to completely pull them like in the village where they isolate themselves forever. Their plan to just amass enough people to spread outwards. And from that alone, I thought it was kind of improbable that they could succeed. The twist kind of shows you just how much more of a threat they could be when they're much more collected, in terms that there's actually more than one community in the area. Much, actually, one whole section we find out is all in on this.
I loved that. I know we're jumping ahead to the end of the movie, but I thought that was a fantastic ending.
Yeah, and I had already been thinking, because it's a cult and it's in Los Angeles, so I'd already been thinking about the invitation, and then the ending really just kind of solidifies it even more. But yeah, that is a very creepy ending, and it feels like this is where we start 1BR, the TV series. You know, she turns into the fugitive, and we follow her for 5 years, running away from the cult members trying to catch up with her.
Right.
I liked how the ending came out. Again, we're talking about anything and anything, so it doesn't matter if we start talking about the ending. But I do like the fact that it doesn't necessarily end happily, and it also ends like the invitation where they think they made it, but they really didn't.
It's more hopeful though, because the last thing you see is her making a fist and taking off.
Yeah.
So you never see her get caught again. You see her make a fist and she's determined. So,
being determined doesn't necessarily mean you're going to make it out. I mean,
right, I'm saying I found this
she's
ending
be
more
defined.
Hopeful, more hopeful than the invitation. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, right. But it's also like compare this to the end of the remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Donald Sutherland screaming at her. What happens after that is very much up in the imagination of the viewer. They do leave it. I agree. The fact that they don't just have her collapsing in a heap or surrounded by people where she clearly has no chance of escaping. The fact that the last thing image we have is her running away does give us some element of hope, but it's also a question of is this a futile fight that she's
about to take. I think it's futile, but I think this is what Chrissy would say is a character beat or something where a growth of the character, right? Because at the beginning she's basically Miley Cyrus coming into L.A. not knowing what to do, and then she hears her favorite song on the radio, and you know she dances and parties in the USA, and then that's what this is about. So by the time the movie's at the end, she actually is dancing and partying in the USA because she's determined. She's willing to fight. She knows that she can fight back. And even if she gets hurt or dies, at least she gave it the college try. I think that's what this film can boil down is the whole plot away and just talk about the development of the character from a meek person who had terrible experience with her family and in a city that she doesn't know anything about, with dreams that are probably going to be shattered, but she goes through hell and she comes out strong.
Well, it also
adds,
it was also adds the very fact that it comes, it echoes back to what her friend had said to her, it's your fucking life.
Yep.
You know, it's basically that out of everybody else who has conformed or has perished in their struggle, she's one of the few that actually broke free, whether it's futile or not. She has done what some of the others had could not do in the face of the cult. And that's basically the whole progression of her arc, in that she managed to still hold on to her sense of self, even in the face that her adversity is way too much for her to fight alone.
Yeah, because she... I liked in this movie, too, what they did with her arc as well, because you were never totally sure. Like, even after she joined the cult, or, you know, we're just, like Mike pointed out, we're just calling it a cult. It's really kind of more like a social mindset construct, I guess. But for our purposes, cult just works. I never trusted whether she was fully in or not. And I kind of liked that. That actress played that really well. And that you were never totally sure if she was stringing them along a little bit she could look for her opportunity. I mean, I just thought that was really interesting. They, for a good 25 minutes of the film, I was like, is she really broken or is she fucking with them? Like,
well,
I
quite frankly, I was surprised she passed the lie detector test.
Yeah, me too. I was, but maybe she was on board there for a little bit. I think she may have finally broke, similar to Lester, when she saw a horrible thing happen to someone that is much stronger than her mentally, and Lisa.
But then she learned more.
Right. So she, I think she may have finally succumbed and was in the Stockholm, but then when she saw her good friend, or potential good friend, the only person that showed her any love in the city, real love in the city, being tortured and actually fighting back, I think that's when her opinion changed. So I do believe she passed the test.
I think it started to change
before then. When they branded her and then told her she was going to be a cum bucket, I think that's when her opinion changed.
Yeah, okay. All right. I agree with you. But I think she passed the lie detector because the lie detector when she took it, she was on board. But you're absolutely right. But finding out that she was going to be a concubine and then seeing her friend being chosen, which she wouldn't want anything to happen to her. And then they almost killed her father. You know, and I think – so all those things, I think, contributed. You're absolutely right. But I think at the time, she was on board.
I think her actual moment of I'm done with this, though, it wasn't seeing her stronger friend get beat up. It was when her stronger friend, like you said, Phil, the only person who showed her love in the city, turned on her and said, you're a piece of shit or whatever. You never, whatever she said about you're pathetic. You're not, you're nothing. Like, you're just a dick. Yeah. And I think that's when she actually snapped. That's when I think that the character was broken.
Because she's betraying herself as a person, and her friend basically showed her the mirror and says, look, you aren't that girl before. You're this terrible human being now. And she's like, oh my God, I don't want to be that person. Mike, you want to say something?
I think it's a chipping away. I think if I don't think she had a problem being a cum bucket, as long as she was going to be his, what's his name, Brian's cum bucket.
Oh God.
It was that she was going to be Lester's.
Right.
Because you see the look on her face. She's like waiting in anticipation. She's going to be matched up with Brian. Because it's not going to be too bad. But nope, they ended up giving her to the one-eyed, one-eared creepazoid. Who is probably still the better one. But then immediately, like, she's the branding, she was relieved. She thought she was going to be killed. She didn't realize she was going to be, you know, that this was her mark into society and she's been accepted. I think that she immediately has to confront her father, which is the whole thing that drove her away in the first place. So this is, and she has to stand up for herself there, even if she's faking it a little bit. I think it means something that Lester has saved and given her back her sewing machine because it has her name on it. So it's another mark of individuality.
Right.
And that
is also her dream, right?
It's her dream, right? It's calling it. So, and then, you know, you throw her, the fact that she's disillusioned about being paired up with Lester. So she's not really getting what she wanted. And then on top of it, you throw in, who is a strong woman who could remind herself and someone that she had admired and respected before for her individuality, for her ability to stand up for herself.
Right.
I think that's the final thing, but I think
the chipping stone, like you said.
It starts to unravel right away, beginning with the father and then with Lester and then finally with the friend.
Right.
If they had made different choices, I'm telling you, if the father hadn't shown up, if they had paired her up with Ryan, she would have been a happy little cum dumpster.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
It was a three-beat, if you think about it. It was actually a character three-beat, if you think about it. You had three levels of severity with her cracking.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, or cracking, or we should say awakening.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah, so that's a good point, Mike. I think you're right. If the events that occurred were different, she would have became like the doctor or one of the other folks in the complex, the short-haired girl or someone like that. So I think you're right. That's a good point. Yeah. So while someone like Lisa, put it this way, if she was more like Lisa, she would have never came out of that room alive. Right. But since she wasn't like Lisa, I think Mike's right, where she would have become one of them had those three things not occurred back to back to back.
But I also think when you look at real societies like this, and I think of, for me, I always think of North Korea. Nobody knows who are the people in North Korea that are with the program and how many people are just terrified because to speak out because they don't know which of their neighbors are with the program or not, right? And which of their family are. And I think that's right. Kind of where we are with this, right? That we don't necessarily know how much of that community are Lesters who are sort of frightful to step out of line, afraid to step out of line, and how many of them are, you know, the true believers. Right. And there definitely are true believers in there. I think the doctor is. I think the older actress is.
Yep.
And that's going to be a real question. I don't think that anybody is completely unbreakable. I think if you torture and threaten Lisa enough, if you mutilate her enough, and threaten her with more mutilations, she may end up being cowed, right? She may end up being beaten into submission. She may never be someone who's completely on board, or maybe she would be, depends on how much you break her. But I don't think there's anyone who truly cannot be broken at all.
Right. Well, and you know, like with, you mentioned North Korea, you know, you can have the mob or the FBI. If you threaten terrible things to the family, you're apt to succumb. And you know, like in North Korea, if you flee the country, your family then all goes to jail for life. You know, so
for three generations.
For three generations, right? Exactly. If in the mob, you know, you have to take your family has to disappear too, or you know, you're in trouble. And if it's the IRS or the FBI, then they go after your relatives and your company and all these other things. So if you refuse to give them what they want, so you're absolutely right. It's sometimes you are coerced into doing things that you don't want to do, never mind mentally broken as well, right? So it's authoritarian power where you don't have control to say no. Because, you know, like for example, this girl here, Sarah, if she tried to make contact with her father or friends such as Lisa before Lisa – got sucked into it, they would have killed them probably. You know, so it's yeah, I see what you're saying, Mike. There's almost everybody could have a breaking point if it's to protect others, never mind them, their own, you know, mental stability or free will, for that matter. What did you think of them executing those who can't help the community anymore because of age?
I thought it was really creepy because of how it was just almost like this. It leads you to believe it's like this little, you know, get well party, and then it just gives you that false sense of security, and suddenly they're all saying goodbye. It was, and how accepting she was of it. It was, you know,
I thought it was nice.
It reminded me of Edward G. Robinson in Soylent Green, where, you know, like he's happy and then they kill him and then they send him to the food fountain. I mean, it's a terrible thing. But you're right. It's they're brainwashed to think that after a certain age, all right, we just, yeah, you know what it is? It's like the goddamned horse in Animal Farm. That's why I brought Animal Farm up, because, you know, they have the horse doing all the work and he's a hero. And then when no one's paying attention, the pigs sell him to the farmer to make hamburger.
To make glue. It was sent to the glue factory.
Yeah, to the glue factory. You know, and instead of, and they promised a different thing, which is, you know, if you do great, you know, whatever, then you get to retire and you're treated with dignity and respect and have food and shelter and all that.
Is, though, she didn't seem upset about it. She was like, but yeah, this is the way this happens, and it's my time, and I'm happy you're all here, and give me the gas.
The way they did it, too. It was so primitive. But do you think she was in the right state of mind to make that decision, though?
She's in a cult, or whatever you want to call it, right? Is any of them in their right, or any of them in the right state of mind? I think, look, there is certainly a rational argument to be made about euthanasia, right? We've had this debate in this country for a long, long time. And, you know, right now, things being what they are, our society is very much on the you don't kill old people because they're inconvenient.
Right.
But it's certainly not because there's no logical argument against it, or in favor of it. It's there are definitely arguments you can make where you'd say, well, it makes some sense to do it that way. I mean, hell, we're having something like that. I know, Christy, you were saying that this is a nice escape from the real world, but I couldn't help but see what we're going through in the real world now, because this is all argument of, am I putting my needs ahead of the community? What do we do? Is it okay to sacrifice the old people to help the community? You know, it happens to be straddling two sides of the fence in terms of this issue that we're going through right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's because this is an evergreen question. You know, we don't believe in total anarchy. We don't believe in total selfishness. We also don't believe in completely subsuming our identity for the good of the whole. You know, but then that's where we're dealing with a tension right now in our society, is that we've had to move the goalposts a little bit and out of the range that people have been familiar with their whole life.
Right. Well, no, and I think the reason that I escaped the real world with this movie is because, although the communism and the social stuff, it, for me, that was on the peripheral, because I was so busy watching her character arc, and I really kind of saw this as a story about family or lack thereof. I saw this as a story about identity or lack thereof. So as much as these social issues were definitely there and present in the background, that did not pop out to me as the forefront, just because it wasn't what popped out at me. That's all. It doesn't mean it's not there.
No, obviously. But, yeah. I think it's fair to say, you know, we're all seeing this in a slightly different view, but I think it's all very, very valid. I think, you know, when you look at these communities, at these kind of cults, almost always they're not going home to their family at night. You know, they're These are usually people who are having some sort of isolation. You know, that was an important thing, whereas, you know, the fact that, and I think the fact that it's in Los Angeles or in Hollywood, where a lot of people leave their family behind to go chase their dreams, more so than, you know, than other cities where you do still have it in New York, you know, to a degree. But Los Angeles is known for that, is known for everyone who's got dreams of going to the movies, and they all cut off their support system. And, you know, you look at most of the people in terms of Jonestown, you know, they lost contact with their families. The cult is your new family. That's your new support system. They're supposed to replace them. And people with strong support and strong identities don't get dragged into these things.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you this. My mother used to work at University of Lowell, or what's now called UMass Lowell, basically the alma mater of Abe. And she saw, and I won't name the group, but she saw individuals that were very like loners or, you know, quiet, shy, depressed, mentally ill, whatever, introverts get literally targeted by certain groups.
Mm-hmm.
That, and I'll mention the group, the specific group after the podcast. I won't name them now. And they harass
these kids. Is it the fantasy football players?
No, you'll probably know who they are if you really think about it. And they harass these kids over and over, and she saw a lot of them just like cry and finally have to snap because, you know, leave me alone. So yeah, they go after these type of folk, and in this movie here, what they do is they look for the that type of person when they're doing their showing of the apartment, because they have an open house and they invite like lots of people, and then they can look through them all from camera angles, and they have other people from probably different parts of the city and different parts of the country and maybe even the world looking in, and they say, all right, these are the group people that you want, and then they weed out them, and then they choose one of those, and they say, they give the apartment to that person, and then they break them. And I think that's what they do. And you were going to say something, Chrissy, related to something like that Mike was also talking about.
Being alone, well, and Mike, isolated?
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing
lack
is,
of identity.
When, yes, it's that lack of identity. A lot of times when people that do not have a strong identity typically show a bunch of similar characteristics. One of them happens to be that sort of, you know, that introverted, shy, social withdrawal.
Can't do well meeting people, can't do well.
Can't, right. That just happens to be. So they are easy to target, Phil, because they're easy to spot, you
right,
know.
Right.
They like, and it's kind of funny because it's, now this does not mean that if you, you know, are kind of introverted and like to hide away in your house that you have no personality. That's not what I'm saying, or identity. That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying that no, that is not what I'm saying, because there's plenty of people I know who are introverts and they really do right. have strong identity. But it's one of the characteristics, and I think there was a specific cocktail they were looking for. You know what I mean? Like, you didn't just have to be, let's say, shy and withdrawn, but you also had to be a little timid, or you also had to be like whatever that cocktail is that kind of hallmarks the I really don't have a strong sense of self. You know, I think that that's what they were really looking for. And I think that's what these groups target, Phil. I think there's an actual cocktail that kind of goes all together. I don't think it's just one characteristic or another. I think that's what I was trying to say.
Basically, it's like almost like the hunting animal picking off the straggler, you know?
The little weak one or whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because they're easy to victimize, you know, and it's like, I would imagine that Jim Jones and these religious cults that you guys were talking about earlier, I would imagine they too were looking for people who might have exhibited this cocktail, pardon me, of characteristics, because they were impressionable, you know, and they're easier to mold. Plus, they probably have weaknesses because they did come from trauma. You know, I mean, we know now that trauma is something that is done to you, right? And if you have a certain amount of trauma, I was watching, what is that, Daryl Hammond, the guy on Saturday Night Live? He's got a documentary about his life and the abuse he suffered as a child. He's an SNL guy. He used to imitate Bill Clinton all the time. But there's a documentary on Netflix on him right now. It's called Cracked Up. And he talks about how trauma that is done to someone often results in this kind of lack of identity. So they're also sort of looking people for people that, you know, with trauma. And one of the earmarks of trauma is a destabilization of relationships. You know, you notice at the end they had couples coming in. And even when she went into the open house, there were couples, you know. And you could tell the guy in this couple of glances, he was just kind of not even paying attention to them. Why? Because they were more stable. They had found, hopefully, a healthy relationship or a relationship at all, you know. So they weren't going to want those because it's tougher to break a couple than it is to break an individual, I think.
Yeah, you're not alone.
Yep.
Yep. But anyway, I hope that was helpful, what I just said. But anyhow.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. A lot of times we say things that nothing to add because you summed it up perfectly. Yeah.
I'm still worth something around here.
Well, and all of us. I mean, a lot of times Mike or anybody else will say something and no feedback because it's right on. Let's see. What else? That was
unless it's one of my jokes.
Oh, yeah. I know. Michelle Barak, we feel sorry for you. When Mike says something, too, that he has to keep the day job still.
Yeah, it'll work for me.
Yeah, that's true. As long as it didn't work for you, that's all. Let's see. Any other scenes or parts of this film that we haven't brought up that anybody wanted to bring up?
Well, I do know my wife was particularly made audible noises when she yanked her hand off the nail.
That was rough.
That's certainly one of those moments, you know, when we do the year-end awards. Clearly, this is going to be one of my top 20, certainly. This is a fucking phenomenal year. But it's also going to be runner-up for – or in the running, rather, for, you know, the – not kill of the year, but like the wincing moment of the year and for the end
that
of the year.
That moment was incredibly toe-curling, but I also liked that it was subtly done. They didn't really overdo that. They could have really made it like so disgusting that you were just running from the room, and they didn't.
I actually squirmed more when they put the nail in the hand, and when they didn't show the second hand getting the nail, I was like, oh, thank God they didn't show that one.
And I did like the fact that they point out later that they were careful as to like where to place the nail to minimize the long term damage, because that's. That's one of those things.
When the doctor talked about it, she talks to the guy and goes, "You did an excellent job. You got it right spot. I trained you well," or whatever. It was like, geez.
"You did well, young Padawan.
Good job, Danielson."
Yeah. So I'm glad they did that too, because that. And see, that's a smart screenplay, right? Because a bad screenplay would just forget that injury occurred. And you know, in real life, an injury like that may put someone out of commission for weeks. The hand should be covered with you know, infection, you know, all that stuff. And here they kind of have that one line just to clear up, so you wouldn't be bothered about that 20 minutes later, you know. And I like that, because we always complain when we, you know, for nitpicks, that when we talk about some of these films, all they had to do was put a one line in to explain it, and then no one would have thought about it, worried about it. I mean, like you, Eric, you always say, you know, once it's out, my mind is out of the film because it's something stupid. All they had to do was add that one line, and he didn't. And
they did hear.
Yeah, they did hear, which was great. So Mr. David Marmor, or however you pronounce his name, was smart to add that little thing in there. And by the doctor, too. I liked it. It wasn't just like some scrub character. It was someone that would know.
But it does make me wonder, like, the writer at some point had to be like, you know, go to their doctor and say, I'm just curious. If I was going to put a nail through someone's hand in a way that wasn't going to cripple them for life, where would you recommend I put that nail?
That's probably not as weird as you think it is, because writers have to do research on shit all the time.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I'm just saying.
There's a big joke in the writing community that if somebody, like, especially in the horror community, that if I died, or, you know, oh my God, if I died and they looked at my computer, the last things I Googled were like how to poison people and, like, you know, how to, like, have somebody, how long does it take a body to bleed?
Very questionable search.
Like, shit like that. Yeah. It's so funny.
Random decomposition of bodies in Northeastern Connecticut.
They would think I'm a freaking murderer or something, or like, but that meme comes up a lot in the horror writing communities. Like, every once in a while somebody will come out and go, oh my God, I just looked at the last 10 things I Googled, and if I died, somebody would think I was a really fucked up motherfucker. Like, you know, how long does it take to torture a cat to death? I mean, like, all this sort of stuff. It's so awful. Oh, my
Lord.
When
baking a cat, how long do I leave it in the oven?
I was about to say, what temperature should I bake my cat at?
Right. Well, and that's the thing. That was the one thing that bothered me the whole film, because I just kept on saying, if that was my pet, I'd kill these motherfuckers ASAP. Yeah, so when she wasn't doing it, going, yeah, acting was Stockholm, I was like, this is bullshit.
I actually thought that moment was really well done, because you got the point, but you really did not see anything. I thought that was very well done. Like, I think a lesser film would have said, ooh, we could, like, show a, you know, like an ear or something, you know, and that would have just been too gruesome for people to deal with. So I really liked the fact that you
still
completely
rough.
Got the point.
Yeah.
Oh no, you were still horrified by it. But the writers,
I wasn't horrified.
The horror speak for itself is what I'm saying. And that just worked so much better than doing a whole bunch of things that might not have been cool.
The reason I wasn't horrified was because you know the rabbit in the pot, you know, scene from Fatal Attraction. So, but the thing that bothered me wasn't that, it was rage. Like, those motherfuckers killed my family, and the cat was, you know, I'm not a cat fan, but I mean, you know, the cat was a good cat, doesn't deserve to die. It hung out on the couch, and, you know, it was all right. It wasn't its fault that the girl was stupid to go to an apartment that didn't allow pets, and then the cat's like her family, you know, sibling, child, whatever you want to call it. They killed it. That's revenge. That's vengeance. That's,
yeah. I would have difficulty going to a place that, even when I was of that age, I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, when I was just out of college and I didn't have a pet, I might have taken an apartment like that. But I'd be really careful about going into a community like that, because who wants to be around a bunch of people who don't like pets?
Yeah, right.
Well, that's not the reason why they usually do that. The reason why is because they don't want the pet to damage.
Oh, I know. I understand that. But still, I don't know that I could handle a no pet property.
Right. Well, usually what it is, you're right, because they didn't explain, but a lot of times they allow, like, fish tanks or birds or something, but they don't want cats or dogs. Basically, when they say no pets, they really just mean cats and dogs.
No real pets.
Unless it's a cult and they don't want you to have any social attachments at all.
Exactly. And the way they killed the pet, that was kind of gross. You think they would have just kidnapped it and dumped it or something, but to cook it alive, it's just fucking stupid. That was probably just the horrifier, or just was a great moment.
And clearly they left it in there too long, because that was just completely inedible by the end.
It was going to be all dried out. What kind of sauce could you even put on that to make it?
Seriously, it's like the turkey from Christmas Vacation.
Yes.
Worst barbecue ever.
You're all going to hell.
Sometimes cats are eaten in other parts of the world, you know, so I, but
dogs too.
Dogs too, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
You know, the next time Mikey does something bad, I'm going to cook him, and I'll let you know how long it should have actually taken. How about
and
that?
And let's hope he learns his lesson.
Yeah. Maybe he will.
Some places they eat bats as well.
Yes, this is true. This is very true.
I have eaten
chocolate covered ants, and I have eaten chocolate covered baby bees.
Oh, I had a chocolate covered.
They're very dry.
They're very dry.
I had a chocolate covered cricket once.
Yeah, they're dry. It's very strange.
All right, now you guys can try. You can try really eating the murder anything. Hornets now too.
I had pig's feet and pig's ear, but I don't think that's as weird as insects.
I don't know. Those eggs are crunchy.
Oh God! All right, I think is this the sign that our conversation about
about this film is just about done. I mean, I think we're about over it.
Yeah. All right. So that's fair. All right. So Mike and Abe, we actually have a special part of the podcast for tonight. And what's that all about, Mike?
Well, we are here meeting with three of the creators of a film that we've just covered on the podcast, which is the new indie film 1BR. And I think we're all pleased with the film to one degree or another. And we're just excited to have you here to discuss the little project that you created and have given us to make our way through the quarantine together.
That's right. And so let's introduce the folks here. So I guess we got the writer and director. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Dave Marmer. I wrote and directed 1BR.
Excellent. And we have the producer.
Luke Mishra, yeah, I was the producer of 1BR, along with many other amazing producers as well.
Excellent. And we have the lead actress of the film.
Hi, Nicole Braddon-Bloom. And yes, I had the pleasure of working with these two men and a wonderful cast and crew.
Excellent. That's great. And yeah, we actually just found the film. It just popped up on iTunes, and I noticed that it was getting good reviews. And so I suggested that we should probably watch your film and do an episode on it. And so we went in blind. We didn't know anything about it. We didn't. Only one or two of us watched the trailer. None of us read the blurbs, and we just went in completely blind. And yeah, as Mike said, we pretty much all liked it. So let's go around and ask some questions, because we have some questions about the whole film and whatnot. And Abe, why don't you start?
All right. I guess I'll start. Ask Mrs. Bloom. How did you first learn about the project? Did you approach Mr. Marmar, or were you requested yourself?
So my agent sent me David's script, and you know, I read through it for interest, and I really loved the material. I really loved his writing. I liked the story. So I ended up putting myself on tape and got good feedback. And, you know, eventually it was kind of a funny casting process, but I was fortunate enough to end up booking the role. And I felt very lucky. And it was, you know, one of my first big projects out of school. So that was very exciting for me. And it all kind of happened in a wonderful way.
Nice. Now, Mike, you had some questions too. You had a question.
Yeah. So let me actually go to David, since you wrote this as well as directed it. While we were discussing the film last week, we noted that there's really a lot of different ways to interpret it and apply it. And I was just curious, what was your inspiration for it? Was there something specific you were looking at, or was it just sort of a more general kind of approach to that mindset, shall we say?
No, I mean, the short-ish answer is that it was sort of the combination of two things that were floating around in my head when I was in my early 20s and I first moved to LA. And one was that I moved into an apartment complex that's kind of similar to the one that ended up in the movie. And I was in some ways, you know, I was in some ways similar to Sarah, in that I was not confident. I felt very isolated and very lonely. And I found the environment of the apartment complex to be just naturally scary. You know, without any need for ghosts or anything crazy, you know, it's just, you're surrounded by people you don't know. You're sharing walls with them. You're waving to them on the breezeways, and you don't know anything about them or their lives. And there was something really scary about that I started thinking about, like, how could I capture that? And then at the same time, I was also getting really interested in utopian communities and fringe religions and such, of which there are many in LA. It seems to really breed them. And so then, you know, the idea that of sort of combining those two things just happened. And you know, at that point, I felt like I kind of had at least the core of a complete story. And that was when I started writing the script.
I guess for you, Alok, how did you get involved with this and in producing itself? Because as we see, or I see in the IMDb of both David and Nicole, they haven't had done much things yet, and yet what they produced was fantastic. But what made you say, okay, I have faith in these people? I'm guessing, because I'm not really sure how the producer roles really work now, and especially in the indie circuit.
Well, you know, the whole thing of it was that before I started producing films, I did market research for films. So I tested movies for 18 years, and my partner Shane Borster and I have this company called Malevolent Films, and he also used to test movies as well. And so we decided we were going to set up on our ways and make a movie. And it just turns out that my wife went to high school with David's manager, who's also a producer of the film. Allard Cantor and also Jared Murray make up the company Epicenter, the management company. And we had one of those lunches with Allard, my wife and I did, where, you know, you sit around, talk, you know, have a glass of wine. You know, what are you working on next? And like, here's two scripts. Let me give you two scripts. And he gave me two scripts. And I'll be honest, I was working on something else and I was really knee deep in that. I didn't look at it for 6 months until the project I had fell through. The two scripts he gave me, one of them was Tragedy Girls, which you may have heard of, yes. Great director, Tyler McIntyre. I read that one and I passed on it because I really feel it's hard to do comedy and horror. Both sides are never satisfied. However, that being said, they did a great job with that movie. And I said, like, yeah, I got to pass on it because of these reasons. And they're like, yeah, yeah, we just finished, you know, shooting that a week ago. And I was like, yeah, what the fuck do I know? Like, so the second script was David's script. And I loved it. I thought it was great. We, you know, met at the Culver Hotel. We talked, you know, we talked about our favorite movies, our sensibilities. And it came down to a thing where, you know, we actually had to pull the script back. It was even better in certain ways, but we could only afford a certain amount of it, let's say. So, you know, my producer partner, Shane Worcester, and myself decided, let's take a chance on this. We're first-time producers. He's first-time writer-director. What could go wrong? So that's sort of the origin story, if you will, of it coming together.
Fantastic. Abe, you got some more questions?
Yes. This is for David. When creating the community, did you use real-life references or data to kind of build the rules and how these people interact with each other?
Yeah, there's a lot of research that went into it. You know, the underlying ethos, I guess, of the community, the four foundations and their whole sort of you know, their reason for existence was something that I basically made up. But that was even that was kind of informed by research, because one of the things that I thought was really interesting when I started reading a lot about these groups was that almost every one of them started with very noble goals. They don't start out trying to be repressive. They don't start out trying to be a suicide cult. They start out with really lofty ideals. I mean, even in some ways, the Manson family, if you look at sort of what they thought of themselves when they started. And I got really interested specifically in a group called Synanon that started in L.A. in the late 50s that was it was a drug rehab when there was not such a thing, really. It was not, you know, drug addiction was very stigmatized, even more so than today. And there just wasn't a place for people to go for help. And they created that and they helped a lot of people. But then it kind of metastasized into something really dark, as a lot of these do. And I found that process really fascinating. So my goal in sort of creating the community was to create something that had a really positive underlying message, something that I felt like I could believe in, that I, you know, felt like was an ideal in some way. And then try to figure out how that would be twisted, how you take something that should be good and push it to this extreme that where it becomes really oppressive. So that was sort of the underlying philosophy behind it. A lot of the details of how they indoctrinate people, how they, you know, how they go about trying to break Sarah down and then build her back up, was a combination. A lot of the psychological techniques are taken from real groups, you know, Synanon, as well as many other, groups. And then some of the physical stuff, that happens was, a lot of that came from, U.S. military intelligence, interrogation techniques, unfortunately. I made up very little.
Now Mike. All right.
Clara, one of the things that impressed me in watching the film was that you had to, there are a number of occasions where you have to deliver a number of different emotions simultaneously. What Sarah is portraying to the camera and to others around her, as well as what's probably going on inside. I think, for instance, when she's confronting her father in the middle of the film. Mm-hmm. How do you go about preparing for something like that, that requires that kind of nuance, where you might not have an easy experience to draw back on?
Yeah, I mean, I think a big part was leaning into David's writing and, you know, the story that he had kind of set up. And we did talk through a little bit of the, particularly with the scene with the dad, you know, the history of that relationship, which was helpful. David was really helpful on set, kind of talking through different takes and you know, giving me the opportunity to explore a few different things with it. Yeah, I mean, it was definitely challenging. I think in terms of preparation, we were a bit limited. I did come onto the project, you know, a few days before we started. So it was kind of an experiment for me, exploring, you know, how to go with things while also staying true to the story and where Sarah is in a particular moment. So I don't know. It was challenging, but I think it was also a lot of fun. Those are usually the most interesting scenes to do because it really does push you and it gives you a lot of opportunities to kind of, you know, as a human, I have a million thoughts in 1 second, whether you're having a fight or, you know, you're telling someone that you love them, right? You have so many things going on in the back of your mind. So it's kind of fun to explore that when you're playing another character. You know, what are those other thoughts going on in their mind? Well, you know, on the surface, I'm telling my dad that I hate him or that I can't be around him, you know.
You know, Nicole is just being modest. This is a loke, by the way. We had a cast of another actress who dropped out like 3 or 4 days before, and then in turn the guy that we cast as Brian also dropped out, and because that was her friend for some reason. We had, you know, made the mistake of casting friends, and then we also then lost our older lady actress who plays Miss Stanhope. Susan Davis plays it now. She's amazing. She was in like War Games. She's just a terrific actress. But that actress, the other actress we had, her husband collapsed, was rushed to the hospital and died. So we lost three people in 1 day. And we were like, what the hell do we do now? So Nicole actually, as it were, was our first choice. The other actress had sort of a slightly bigger name because she's in TV and what have you. And you know, Nicole said yes. After one day, she was our favorite choice, to be honest. And she flew out like the next day, which was a Thursday or something. She only met with David, and Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, like for like 5 hours, rehearsed for 5 hours, and then just showed up to set and made it work. Like, you know, just, we were shooting for 15 days. Wasn't a lot of time. And like, she just came in and, you know, Dave can tell you made scenes work. Dave, you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've told Nicole this before, so hopefully this won't be too embarrassing for you, Nicole, but I literally think we might not have been able to finish the movie if we had not had her in this role. She's, you know, she's an incredibly skilled actor, and just, you know, was able to portray that complexity that you know, that you're talking about, like those levels. She would get there on the first take, and then, you know, it really made my job very easy in some ways, because, you know, we would have it on take one, and then it was like, okay, well, let's explore. We have a little time, you know, unbelievably on a 15-day shoot, we have a little time to explore this scene. So yeah, it was really, you know, Nicole is remarkable.
She can cry 8 different ways. I can just tell you that. She's amazing. Like, she'd be like, we'd be doing a scene and she'd cry and said, oh, wait, let me do it again. And then he'd cry and it'd come perfectly where we're supposed to, the tear. It was amazing. Like, she has a very, very bright future. If anything, I feel like she's like kind of like our Jamie Lee Curtis of sorts, in the way that she's going to be so big in the future. And we're going to be like, ah, we were so smart, we cast her. We're brilliant.
Well, it's kind of funny that you said that, because when we were setting up the interview with you folks, with your the PR person, I was talking to one of our co-hosts who couldn't make it tonight, and said that, won't it be cool to be able to interview David and Nicole, because in a few years from now they could be the next big things in Hollywood. So, So I have a question for you, Nicole, because I guess to follow up on what we just discussed, you are obviously were one of the less experienced actors on the movie, and yet based off your resume from your website, we saw that you were the lead as Belle and things of that nature in plays, and that's pretty impressive to just get a lead role for that character. So how was it to work with all these experienced character actors and actresses in this film here, and yet you're the lead and you're the person that has to, as a look mentioned, go through all the different emotions to make the role what it was?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it was intimidating, except it wasn't, because the entire cast was so kind and so supportive. And, you know, Taylor and Naomi and Giles, who played kind of the three arguably main cult members, were fantastic and so helpful. You know, whenever I had any questions, if, you know, David was on set and I just, you know, needed to run something by someone in terms of any advice for being on camera, you know, the other side of things, they were incredibly helpful. And it was, it honestly, they made my acting so much stronger, just in that I felt comfortable taking risks and, you know, kind of following their lead. But yes, I have been fortunate I grew up doing theater and have had some wonderful opportunities with that. So I think in terms of carrying a show, I was familiar with that, like you say, with, you know, Belle and Beauty and the Beast, although the subject matter was quite different. and it's different on camera, you know, it's a different medium, and, you know, you're shooting out of order. And so kind of keeping that on track was new for me. But like I said, David was incredibly helpful with that. But yeah, I mean, it was exciting. I was nervous and also just thrilled for the opportunity and the chance to work with so many talented people.
Very good. Abe, you got a question?
Yes. This is for Nicole. When working with the rest of the cast, you had to try, was it challenging to adjust from being the new, you know, tenant to now being essentially this apprentice, these two kind of shifting roles when you, when Sarah is being converted, was it difficult to try to change how you interacted with the cast in the almost pretty much in the middle of that film?
Do you mean when I realize what's going on, like in the room, or do you mean kind of later on when they're sort of training me in what they do?
When you're being trained, essentially, because you go from just being this new face in the apartment to now prisoner, then to the apprentice, essentially.
Yeah. You know, I think that had a lot of nuance to it as well, because you know, the question is sort of where is Sarah on this journey. You know, she wants love, she wants family, as you know, many people do, and at some point it kind of seems like they could be that. So I think David and I sort of discussed, you know, the positive aspects of this community that are appealing, even given, you know, the situations that they put her through kind of towards the beginning. Psychologically moving past that and kind of accepting it and understanding that everybody's gone through it. So, you know, I'm just like everybody, and I'm a part of this family. So I think we did discuss that was a need that she perhaps saw the opportunity to fulfill with these people. But then I think there's the layer of, you know, she isn't entirely convinced perhaps half the time. So yeah, that was definitely challenging to navigate, I think, because there were moments I was shooting that I was like, oh, I think Sarah loved these people. And then there were moments that would cause me to falter, you know, but I think that was helpful. And I think going from, you know, playing their neighbor early on, that was kind of an easy beginning. And then, you know, it gets very complicated from there. But yeah, I don't know. It was a little challenging to go back and forth a bit.
I remember that being sort of one of the hardest things for both of us to grapple with. I mean, you know, on top of that, to be shooting all that out of order so that we had to also keep track of sort of where we were in that arc. But, you know, the script is playing a guessing game with the audience to some degree as to, you know, how much she has actually bought into the group and how much she's just pretending to, you know, or going along to survive. And, you know, I remember we had discussions about that for each scene, mm-hmm. because we kind of had to decide for ourselves, even if the audience wasn't necessarily going to know, you know, I felt like you needed to know, and I'm sure you felt like you needed to know, you know, in order to be able to play the scene specifically.
Yeah.
I don't remember what we said at all, but I remember that we had the conversation.
Well, I think we talked about, I mean, certainly the scenes with the lie detector. You know, early on, I falter and I'm not completely honest. But then, you know, as we progress with that, I think Sarah is honest. And, you know, whether that means she's 100% with the community or just honest in those moments, that's kind of like what we're discussing, you know, the challenge of which one is it. But I think we tended to lean more like, well,
no, if you want me to
stay.
No spoilers.
Yeah. But it definitely was a challenge.
Nice. Mike, you got a question?
Yeah. First of all, I did see Tragedy Girls, and I did like Tragedy Girls, but I loved 1BR, so I think you both made the right decision in terms of what film to make. And David, to get back, one thing you said was a lot of these cults start out with good intentions. I always remember the line from George Carlin, which was something like, when the fascists come to America, they won't be wearing brown shirts, they'll be wearing smiling faces. And I guess you could go back to the old Reagan line from the government, and I'm here to help. But yeah, always be careful of people with good intentions. I'm wondering, obviously we're in a weird situation right now with the shutdown. How is this hurting or helping your efforts to promote the film? Obviously, a lot of people are home streaming things, so I would think that's a good thing. On the other hand, it might be hard to get the word out. You're not getting film festivals and stuff to set out. So I don't know How is that affecting all of you and this ability to expose people to your movie?
Mm. Alok, you probably have the most insight into this.
Well, I can tell you, you know, we actually had a really great festival run. We started off at Fantasia in Montreal. Mitch Davis and those guys are, I mean, they really are tastemakers in a lot of ways. And, you know, because, I mean, they didn't just premiere us. They world premiered, like, Swallow and, like, The Wretched and films like that. And so after that happened, we actually did go on a pretty decent festival run all over the world. And, you know, we built awareness in as much as we could in that regard. Actually, at Fantasia as well, we met who would, you know, later become our sales agent / distributor, Dark Sky MPI. And, you know, we did look around a little, you know, here and there, but they were kind of the best fit for us. And they actually are really great with films of this nature, of this size. They're very much a boutique kind of agency in a way that they donate a lot of time, money, and energy to making a launch do well. I mean, to be honest, the coronavirus did the following things to us. It took us out of like two festivals. We wish it could have been done Chattanooga. Unfortunately, we couldn't. And then there's another one in Europe. So that was a loss in that regard. But and then also we didn't get our. We were supposed to have a small theatrical release and a small premiere, none of which happened because of, you know, the coronavirus. But on the bright side of it all, I mean, people are home, like watching and streaming stuff, and they are bored. And it's a thing where I think we're getting a little bit more of a bump in that regard. I mean, if we're honest, you have most of your business coming through VOD. Your theatrical is probably really small for a film like this. They're not like taking out big, you know, television commercial ads or anything for a film of this size. So in that regard, we are doing well. They're very happy with us. You know, we're definitely in the top 25 for the first 2 weeks. We're in the top four, like on iTunes, Apple TV, sorry, they call it now. And, you know, all the different streaming sites, it's available very wide. So, yeah, did we lose something? Sure. You know, it's all our first film. We wanted to go to the premiere and stuff. And, you know, but on the flip side of it, we are doing well, very well on VOD. So, and I think the other part of it is that being in quarantine sort of speaks to this movie in a lot of ways. People are releasing some different aspects of the film in their daily lives in certain ways.
Well, so, it's the whole debate between individual freedom versus the good of the community, right?
Yeah, yeah, sure, that's sure, exactly sure. The debate we're all engaged in right now.
Yeah, I mean, and other people sort of see it as sort of like there's like a bit of socialism that's sort of coming through with this cult, you know, versus personal freedom as well. And so there's been a lot of different interpretations, none of which in some ways was intended. And David can back me up, I guess, on that. But it just happened to be just the case because of the time and place we're living in. So I think overall, like, listen, you got to turn lemon into lemonade. And we're just so happy that it's gotten a really great response. You know, we had New York Times ads and New York Times reviews. And also we were in, you know, USA Today and different things like that. So it's definitely getting the attention of a lot of, you know, bigger publications, and the horror community has been just wonderful. And stuff, you know, between the Bloody Disgustings of the world and Dread Centrals and everybody else, everyone has been super supportive. They love the film. I think they like it when they see a little film that's not made for a lot of money actually kind of succeed. And so there is sort of an underdog sort of thing going on with it. And, you know, listen, the best thing you can do for us and what you're doing right now is tell your friends. I used to work in Testy Movies, and we had a score on the card that was like, would you definitely recommend it to friends? And what we found out, what we knew, was that if you definitely recommend it to your friend, you tell your friend this film is awesome or whatever, that goes so much further than us, you know, cutting together the best trailer we can or buying that optimal ad space or whatever else. It's your opinion that's going to really have the influence on your friends. So one thing I ask of everyone who may be listening to this, if you do watch the film and you do like it, then please tell everyone you know. And if you don't like it, then shut up. Like.
Well, I think a nice thing, first of all, horror community is probably the best community to embrace, of the genres, to embrace low-budget films, because it's, yeah, you know, where the genre thrives. You know, you think of films like Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Halloween. Mm-hmm. But what's nice about the film is that we always had to be careful. Like, if we were going to recommend a movie like Martyrs, which I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Oh, yeah, I know that
movie. Yeah, Martyrs.
Love the film. Really disturbing. You can't recommend it to everyone. different people have different sensibilities. You can't recommend something because, you know, if there's too much sex or violence or gore or bad language, you know, different people are turned off by different things. And while I think this is a disturbing film on a lot of levels, the worst moment in it is probably the thing with the cat, and you really don't see much or dwell on that. It's it's just have some
My parents made their film club watch it, so it was a bunch of it was like several couples all in their 70s, none of whom watch horror movies at all, and I think all but one of them got all the way through it and seemed to like it. So you know, it's probably Alok's going to kill me for saying that your 70-year-old parents or grandparents could watch it.
and there's people out there who'll say, I won't watch a horror movie, but I like this, so therefore it must not be a horror movie. When you
it falls in various categories. It could be considered a thriller almost as well, and almost everybody loves thrillers. So
yeah.
I think it's a psychological thriller with elements of horror.
Yeah.
That's what I would call it in some ways.
Well, I always say a psychological thriller is just a horror film in a necktie. You know, it's just dressed
like
up
that.
A little bit.
A semantic, right?
Yeah.
You know, David, I have a question for you. Usually when we talk about films, a lot of times we go in hoping the film's good, and a lot of times we watch the film even before, because we try to do films that folks are interested in. And one of the things that I notice when I review films is every so often I'll complain about something like, that was silly, but if they just added one line in the script, everything would be fine, and it would answer it, and okay, we can move on, and it won't take me out of the experience. And I use the example in your film, the part when the doctor looks at Sarah's hands and says to the guy that nailed her hands in that, oh, you did an excellent job. You got it right at the right spot. You didn't damage any tendons and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And earlier had that, you know, I was thinking, like, how can that, you know, work without her going to the hospital? But then you answered it by having that one line in there, and then I was satisfied, especially by the doctor character to say it. So how meticulous were you into your script to get those little nitpicks that someone like me would have picked up?
I mean,
yet you fixed it for me. I'm sorry,
you know? I think that I mean, that just is my personality. I think I'm similar to you in that way. Like, I want those questions answered to my satisfaction in some way. It doesn't, and like you said, it doesn't have to be much. I just want a sense that we're inhabiting a consistent universe. You know, it doesn't really matter what the physics are of the movie world as long as they make sense and are consistent within themselves. So I put in a lot of work to try to catch all that stuff. And I know I've missed things, and I know there are things that are inconsistent, or, you know, that people will catch me out on. But that is something that's important to me, and that I feel like, you know, even if people don't notice something consciously, I think, you know, those little inconsistencies and those little flaws pile up, and they kind of take you out of the world of the movie sometimes. So yeah, it's always important to me to try to keep everything as tight as possible in that regard. So I'm glad there's somebody out there who appreciates it.
the little things, and yeah. Yeah, I felt that's your script was really tight.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Abe, you got a question?
Yes. This is for David. When writing the characters of both Jerry and Brian, you're essentially showing two sides of the coin in terms of indoctrination. You have the soft-spoken leader, and you have the more enforcer type, with his bag of make-a-good-neighbor torture. what was that like trying to create those two characters and make them feel not only menacing but believable?
I mean, they felt like, in a way that, you know, I'm trying to think of, like, I was talking to somebody else and saying that, you know, the the sort of there was a real question of like who is going to be surrounding Sarah in this community, right? Because you could have almost anybody. You have a whole apartment complex full of people and you could focus on any of them. And I experimented as I wrote with different combinations of people and kind of ended up with the group that's in the movie in that they all kind of fulfilled surrogate family relationships for Sarah. Jerry is in some way a surrogate father, and Miss Stanhope is a surrogate mother, and Brian in some way is a love interest or a partner, a life partner. That's how she looks at him, at least initially. And so then, and then it was a question of what roles do they play in sort of the functioning of the group. And I became really interested in this idea that this is in some, although Jerry is the leader, the group is meant to function as essentially a leaderless society, right? It functions on these principles. They have their constitution or their Bible, and you kill the leader, somebody else is just going to step in and take their place. And so I looked at Jerry and Brian basically as like a master apprentice sort of relationship in some way, that Brian is learning to sort of become who Jerry is. But Brian also, the other thing that we talk about, that they're very keen on this idea that they're trying to create this perfect society. So they're trying to bring in people who fill specific roles. And Brian has this very unique background, having been a soldier, and that he's able to kind of play that role. And so, I feel like I'm not answering the question well, but basically, it was a bit of trial and error and a bit of just kind of like feeling out what felt like, what would happen in this situation? Who would they need in order to be able to do what they do? And they certainly need somebody like Jerry, who has a PhD in behavioral psychology and understands the sort of psychological part of it. And they were also going to need somebody who could do these kind of militaristic interrogation techniques, I guess.
I felt that Brian, too, felt like he was more of like an escalation of that attempt at being a leader. He was far more ruthless. Which kind of goes back to what you mentioned, how these good intentions become more and more tainted as goes along with each generation of leadership.
That's actually a great point. I'm not sure I ever thought of that consciously myself, but yeah, these things, you look at Kim Jong-un versus Kim Jong-il, when you're born into that and you experience it from a young age, it probably does just sort of get more degenerated and more ruthless with each generation.
Thank you very much.
Mike.
Yeah, one thing to comment on that is, I don't know, I think it's called emergence, if you've ever read anything about intelligent systems and so that's where the complex systems will start acting like living organisms. So the idea that it perpetuates its own self without need from top down. And so I love that aspect of it.
And Mike, I actually mentioned that when I said that the cult isn't the leaders, because when the leader died, the cult was just created by the leader, but it's alive by itself. And I kind of, that's a good point, Mike.
Right.
Sorry to interject.
No, that's fine. So let me, Clara, I haven't heard from you in a bit. I'm assuming, Clara, you've seen the film?
It's Nicole.
Nicole, what am I saying?
I think it was a combination of Sarah. Nicole. It works.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Wow, okay. I'm sorry. I haven't been sleeping well lately. All right, so sorry, Nicole.
No.
I haven't heard from you. So I'm assuming you've seen the film?
I have, yeah.
Well, yeah, so sometimes you do get – I've talked to actors. I haven't had a chance to watch the final product yet. And given everything that's gone on the last few months, I don't know if you'd had the opportunity. And I know some actors who just don't like to watch themselves. So I'm just curious. I assume when you put your name out there for auditions, do you have a reel? Do you have like a a clip from this film that you'd want to put in the reel? What's your favorite part of the movie from your point of view as an actress?
Oh, man. I thought that was it was one of the more challenging scenes to film, but I was happy with the final product. You know, I think the scenes when I'm in the room, there's a few moments that I probably would pull from, but one of my favorite scenes was the interrogation. I think it's one of the first lie detector scenes, and it's when, you know, I sort of reveal what went wrong with my dad, and that was actually one of the audition scenes. And so I had done a lot of kind of prep for that scene going into my audition, which was interesting because then, of course, you know, things change when you get on set and you've kind of worked through the material leading up to it or after it or whatever, and you want it to fit in the sequence. But I think, yeah, that was probably one of my favorite moments, and I was happy with how it turned out. But like you say, it is difficult to watch yourself, especially when it's something, you know, we filmed this almost 3 years ago, so is that right? Almost three?
Two and a half, I think.
Yeah. So, you know, it was helpful watching it the first time because you're thrilled with some moments, and some moments you're like, oh, you know, that can be improved or whatever, you know, it's everyone's their own worst critic, I'm sure. But it was awesome seeing the final product, and I was very happy with how it turned out.
Nice. Luke.
Yeah, I got it.
sorry about that. At least I didn't call you a different name like Mike called.
throwing poor Mike under the bus there.
My students.
We usually say the co-host who can't make it is the one we always blame. So, I have a question for you though. A lot of films that we review don't really get picked up by, like you mentioned, the New York Times, and there's other stuff like RogerEbert.com, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, you know, various other places. Your film got picked up by all these bigger things, not just bloggers that were reviewing it or word of mouth. It was like big organizations, newspapers and whatnot that reviewed it. Was it the production people that do that, or is it the PR people, or is it because of Dark Sky was able to do that?
Well, we had a combination of things. When we were going into Fantasia, we didn't have a, you know, distributor or anything like that. And usually they do handle those things because they have a publicist on, you know, staff, what have you. And we actually hired a really great publicist, Kayla Hare, who is fantastic at just genre movies. And I think we had like 28 reviews coming out of Fantasia, including Hollywood Reporter and Variety and things like Roger Ebert, stuff like that. And then, you know, once we had signed the deal with Dark Sky, they also have a really great publicist, Daniela Sapkar, who, you know, got us in the New York Times and USA Today. So, like, yeah, it was very much a team effort. You know, we also had, I mean, I'll be honest, kind of funny stories about even making this movie, which I think made it interesting for some journalists. I actually wrote an article for Movie Maker magazine, if you want to go check it out, on the disaster that our production was. You know, it, despite the fact that it was successful, I mean, our market, you know, relatively successful, we had all of these things that worked against us to make it not so. And, you know, one of which was our, you know, production office almost burned down because we were having fires in California right next to our office. And we couldn't go to the office like, you know, 3 or 4 days before shooting. We lost our cast and actually, of course, traded up with Nicole Brighton Bloom and also Giles Matty and also Susan Davis. But then we also had like day six of the 15-day production. We had like a production truck that got stolen in the middle of the night and was involved in a high-speed chase with the LAPD. And, you know, this is on TV, by the way. And they caught the guy. And, you know, I mean, all this crap going on. And we didn't tell David or Nicole or any of the actors that this had gone on. They just knew that we started an hour late that day. That's all they knew. Like, we told them, like, at the rap party, I wanted to say. And some people didn't even find out till the premiere in Fantasia when I told them the story about, like, the truck being stolen and what have you, and a very hot, handsome convict being arrested. Everyone just thinks this guy's super handsome, even though he's a bastard. He's supposed to pay us restitution. Like, you know, he turned over, it was a big truck-stealing ring, and he was new to the ring, and apparently this is the first time they've ever caught somebody from it, and he turned state's evidence, supposed to pay us restitution. We haven't seen a goddamn dime. But, like, all this crazy stuff happened to make this movie. It's just, like, we're just so lucky it even turned out, you know, I'll be honest. And let alone getting in the New York Times or, you know, RogerEbert.com. I think it was really that we took our time with it. We trusted David implicitly. You know, you want to talk about what we're working on next. I'm working on another movie called Emergent, actually. You just talked about that word, Emergent, with Marcel Sarmiento, who did Dead Girl. And the next one after that, we're doing with David again, because we really did enjoy each other's companies, and it's a special sort of bond that happens when you trust each other and you've gone through hell to make a movie that, and then you get along, frankly, you know, of course your sensibilities are the same, blah, blah, blah. And so we're actually working on a film with him next that he is, trying to put the finishing touches on, that we're excited to work with him again. And, like I said, if we ever have a chance to work with Nicole in a second, I won't even think twice, because she is so goddamn good. Like, I want David to do a Tarantino thing where he works with all his actors and actresses the same. You know, that's my dream in my head. You know, I'll be as Lawrence Kasdan, but I won't kill anybody. Oh, that's terrible. Not Lawrence Kasdan. That's not Lawrence Kasdan. No, it's Lawrence Bender. Lawrence Bender. Sorry, yeah. Lawrence Kasdan. Yeah. We love you.
You're going to get blacklisted for that one.
I know. I'll tell you what. Lawrence Bender, whatever. Anyway. But going back to it, we're very lucky. We're very lucky that it all worked out the way it did. That's all I can say. I mean, it's we're lucky we connected. We're lucky we made the movie, and we're lucky that you guys liked it and are interviewing us.
Yep.
Yeah. We only have a few minutes left, so let's just ask this last question, which is, don't you think Sarah would have wanted vengeance, even if after everything, just for the fact the cat was killed? When you kill your pet, that's vengeance, right? I mean, nothing's going to make you become a cultist after that, right?
Well, I think she, you know, well, we don't want to give anything away, but she probably, it probably informs some of her character arc toward the end of the movie. We can say that.
Fair enough.
There's all also right, so, stuff, I just rewatched it today. There's little things like saying that they had to rush her indoctrination because mm-hmm. she was about to leave. Yeah. So there's stuff like that that is seeded in early in the film, intentionally mm-hmm. or not. I'm just going to chalk it up to being an intelligent script that justifies a lot of what pays off down the road.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, no, that's, yeah.
Yeah. I also like the little details of how it feels like time doesn't really feel constant. You don't get a sense of how long this indoctrination is going on here. You lose right. time as much as Sarah does.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I remember thinking about that and, you know, wondering, like, how I was going to sort of mark the passage of time when you're stuck in this unchanging environment. And, you know, L.A., the weather doesn't even change. And then on top of that, you're locked into this apartment complex. And then I realized at a certain point along the line that could be turned into a virtue. You know, that would just increase our sense of her, you know, of being in this kind of limbo with her. Sorry, my cat is actually meowing to come into the room right now.
Make sure you don't do anything to it.
No, the oven is off.
Okay.
Oh, my wife hated that. She's always had a fear of the cats jumping in the microwave and the oven. Well, I don't know why. So she absolutely hated that.
Well, I mean, she wouldn't check it before she actually turns it on, I guess. Like, that's my question. Like, I mean, don't you look
well, maybe she's worried that they'll hit the button and then close it behind them. I don't know. It's a fear. Fears don't have to be rational.
Here's the model for the cat scene right here.
Ah, there you go.
Oh, is that the same cat? It looks like
no. This is okay. We got a cat. My cat inspired the role. Let's say that.
Gotcha.
Well, you know, the funny thing was that the cat in the script, his name is Giles, and then Brian's like real name is Giles Maddie. Right. And so that cat was so good. Like, that cat would get it like in a take. And we were like, God damn, that's one take Giles right there. Giles, come over here. Look at this cat. He's fucking on. Like, Giles is amazing. Giles Maddie's an amazing actor, by the way. Like he can also cry eight different ways too. Just FYI, like I'm making light of it, but he's amazing as well.
No, he was great because he was like the every guy next door, nice guy, whatever. And then he's a sociopath the second half of the film. Like, so he has a wide range of acting, no doubt about it.
Oh, I think everybody in the cast had to exhibit those two sides, and that's like I said, mm-hmm. that's going to be a great. For their reels, for their showing off their range, this is a really good film for that. It's almost like they can act professionally.
well, and that's the reason why, Nicole, I was telling the co-host who couldn't make it that I think you could be the next big thing because, you know, you were able to lead a role and do all of these different emotions and work with all these different actors, and it was your first role. And unlike a lot of newcomers, they don't have the opportunity to put on their resume leading role in a successful film, you know, direct, reviewed by New York Times and
Dark Discussions.
Yes.
And Dark Discussions, exactly. Well, you know, I'll say this, and I can't say who it was, but Nicole had to leave our premiere early to go do an audition with like an A-list person who we cannot mention apparently. But like, that's how good she already is. Like, she's only going to, like, I completely expect that she's going to be a star after this. Like, I mean, not that she isn't already, of course, but I really do think that.
Well, you are, that's very, very kind. And, you know, hopefully I'll just get to continue to work because I think storytelling is such a cool opportunity. And this was, you know, an incredible experience. So that's very sweet. Thank you.
Now, it is 9:03 Eastern Standard Time, 6:03 Pacific Standard Time, or Pacific Coast Time. So I think since you guys we were technically only supposed to have you for a half hour, but you were lucky, or we were lucky enough that you guys agreed to stay longer. But I guess we can let you guys let folks know where they can find you on the internet, what you guys are doing that's coming up that you want to promote, or things that you've already done that you want to promote. So I'm not sure if there's stuff like that. So Mike's laughing at your cat. That's too funny. So David, why don't you start? Why don't you let folks know what's up and where people can find you and reach you and all that other good stuff?
Well, I have to confess I'm kind of barely on social media, but I did spruce up my Twitter account for this movie, and I'm D Marmor. DMARMOR on Twitter and David_Marmor on Instagram. You know, at this point, I'm just head down. I'm in, you know, social distancing at home with my cat and my wife and my 2-year-old and writing the next movie for Alok.
Yes.
Nice. What about yourself, Alok?
Like I said, you know, I have another movie we're trying to, with COVID, it was supposed to be shooting now. It's not, obviously. We're just waiting for things to open back up again. It's called Emergent. It's, again, Marcel Sarmiento is the director, writer-director. I like writer-directors, as you can tell, because it's only one person I have to deal with as opposed to two people. I have to please. So that's the next one. And then after that, we're finding the money, and Dave's doing a small rewrite on his next film, which we won't even tell you the name of because it's just so amazing, and we want to J.J. Abrams the shit out of this and leave you in wonder and mystery. So in terms of any sort of plug, I'm just plugging the movie here. So if you want to watch it, available on all different kinds of streaming sites. It's on Blu-ray on the 2nd. But like I said, it's on Amazon right now. It's for rental or purchase, as well digital rental or purchase, as well as obviously Apple TV/iTunes, whatever they're calling it now, Google Play, DirecTV, Dish Network, Vimeo, is that right? Vimeo, it's everything. So just please go see it and tell your friends if you like it. That's what I would ask. Thank you.
Very good. What about you, Nicole? Besides the big A-list audition, what else is going on?
things are kind of on hold at the moment, but I have been able to read a couple of cool scripts while in self-isolation, so we'll see when those get off the ground. Hopefully, you know, auditions will go well. I did an episode of Law and Order recently, which was cool to work on, you know, a show that's so established and kind of a staple for New York actors, so that was pretty fun. But other than that, I'm on Instagram. I am on Twitter, although I need to be more active on social media. So I'm working on that as well. But it's all under Nicole Braden Bloom. So
I don't know that anybody needs to be more active on social media.
I was thinking the same. It's a cesspool.
You know what a cesspool is? I swear to God. I go into IMDb, and there are people that I know haven't watched our film that are just giving it ones because they're fuckers. Like, it's going to be a thing where and stop with it. Just don't do that. It's so mean. Like, now they're going to do it more, I know. They're going to do it more now, I know. But it's like,
it was even worse when they had the forums there.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I forgot that. Yeah.
I did read one review, and I will not mention where the review came from. Most reviews I looked at were positive. I read one review that was negative. I had to look at it, and they just did not get the film. That was entirely a shortcoming of the viewer who just missed the point entirely. That would drive me nuts. There's valid criticism for anything, but when you just didn't understand the movie.
Right. Yeah.
Well, or you get that, like, sorry, David, that said reviewer who is just like, you can tell they're watching a screener. It's going on in the background. They're not really watching it though, because they're just like, oh, Nicole Braden Bloom's a terrible actress. And I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? She is like the one ridiculous. Amazing thing out of this film. If you're going to take something away, no offense, Dave, but I'm just saying, like, she's amazing. Sorry, David, I cut you off. What you're going to say?
None taken, I guess. like you said, there certainly is valid criticism of anything, and, you know, not every movie is going to be to everyone's liking. I certainly understand that. Yeah, what I get aggravated at is when there was one particular review that basically it seemed like they had watched about up to the halfway point and then stopped, and then just extrapolated what they thought the rest of the movie was going to be, because the review... It didn't pertain to what actually happened in the movie, and that one really drove me crazy. But mostly they're very kind, and they kind of filter the reviews for me and let me know which ones are positive, and I try to just not read the negative ones.
Well, like I've always say on the podcast, even The Godfather has only 96% good reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. So it's 4% that someone didn't like it for some reason.
Yeah.
Sort of like how Babe Ruth didn't get a unanimous vote into the Hall of Fame, Ted Williams or Jackie Robinson.
Yeah.
Or Derek Jeter, for that matter, recently. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's too funny. So, all right, very well. All right, so a look. And your last name, is it Kumon or is it Mush?
No, it's Alok Kumar Mishra. Mishra is my last name. But Kumar is like Harold and Kumar, right?
Yes, right. That's
and Alok is like joke. It rhymes with Joker smoke.
There you go.
Awoke.
And David Barmore, you are a good screenwriter. Never mind a director. So keep that in mind. Keep on writing because the screenwriting is really what I've discovered.
Sharp.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah. And then Nicole, I'm pretty sure that you'll be fine. yeah, you'll be fine.
Assuming we can ever get back to filming again.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Well, we still have a business. We'll see. But this is awesome. Thank you guys so much for taking the time to chat with us.
Thank you for joining us.
Oh, and one last thing we should thank your publicist, Stacy Cusack, for hooking us up with you folks at Sapcar Public Relations.
Yes.
SAPKARPR.com.
Yeah, they've been fantastic this whole way through, and we're very grateful for them.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting, Mike, we kind of had the ending of your film, David, to the invitation, this marketing company or PR company also did the invitation, as a matter of fact.
Oh.
So, yeah, they did a lot of good films. Spring, We Are Still Here, The Innskeepers, Willow Creek, Human Centipede, The Canyons by Paul Schrader. So there's The Killer Inside Me. Yeah, so they've done a lot of stuff.
Yeah, we liked a lot of those movies.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Oh, Deathgasm too, Mike.
Ooh,
yeah.
Good.
That's a good one.
Talk to Joe Bob about Deathgasm.
Yeah, that's some good stuff. All right, so I guess that's it. I mean, it's always hard to say goodbye.
Hard to say goodbye.
Yeah, so,
but we appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I'll the episode will probably be out tomorrow, and I'll email it over to Stacy, and she can forward it over to you folks. So
perfect.
Okay, thank you guys so much.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. We appreciate it too.
Okay.
Bye, bye-bye. Guys.
Bye.
Later.
Bye.
So before we get into our final thoughts, we have a couple of emails here. Basically, about Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, a Westworld podcast. We have three of them. First one is from Malcolm Johnson. He wrote, "I really need to start this season up, season three. I've been dragging my feet on it. A friend posted a GIF of a dumpster fire, and I got concerned. However, I loved it up to now. I'll probably dig this season as well. Maybe, question mark." So, yeah, very well. That's it's a good, good point. I mean, cool. Yeah, good luck with that. Good luck with that. Jason F. Storm, fellow podcaster, a friend of the podcast. We met him at Scares, the ScareCon. He actually is a member of our Facebook group. We didn't even bring up any of that earlier, but we'll do that in a second. But he wrote, "Wanted to say thanks for a great podcast, Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, a Westworld podcast for this season three. Kept being a couple of days behind to get an email into you guys, but good insight. But however, I guess I enjoyed the season and finale more than you guys." Nolan enjoyed
not hard.
Yeah. Not, that's true. Nolan and Joy seem excited about season four for their larger arc, so hopefully that translates into something good. Of course, what do I know? I'm also hoping for a spinoff of Bernard and Stubbs, mediocre buddy detectives.
That's awesome. That would be the worst show ever.
I know.
She's not here either. Okay, let's go.
Oh my god, that's awesome. Oh, that's awesome. Excellent. Thank you, Jason, for making our day, or at least me and Eric, because we understand what you meant. And Mike too, but Mike seems indifferent because he likes Stubbs and Bernard.
I do. I don't like what they did with them this season.
Yeah.
I mean, think that's where. Look, I'll keep saying I really enjoyed the first six episodes, but part of that was because I was able to say, all right, you know, they're working towards something. They're working towards something.
I agree. It was the first six episodes,
and then I think they didn't really work towards something. And I've heard now, listening to a couple of other things about it, several people say that they didn't like the episode on their first watch and liked it more on their second watch. So I will give it a second chance. I will go back and look at it. I still think the show, as I said then, is impeccably crafted. I just think they fumbled the ball really in the final episode of the season.
Also, you could also be Sean Fox, one of our listeners, who said he watched it a second time and he was very disappointed. His first viewing was, "Oh yeah, this is really good," and the second viewing goes,
"There you go."
And yeah, so you never know. Yeah, it's a fair point.
That is true. But he's also Canadian, so you know they do everything backwards there. They put mayonnaise on fries, and you know,
yeah,
they like hockey. I don't get you know, it's just not a real country anyway.
fair enough. Then we have Elizabeth Catherine Gray, another podcaster where we met through Ski as a Care originally, and she wrote this. She writes, "Hey Mike, Eric, and Phil, I know I've been on the quiet side this season with Westworld and the podcast, but I watched the whole season now. I caught up. I enjoyed it better than season two, but the highlight, as always, is listening to Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, a Westworld podcast on the Dark Discussions Podcast Network. Love, Liz." So thank you very much. Any more feedback, people can write to us at darkdiscussions@aol.com, and we will read your email on the podcast. So if you want to comment as these folks have here, or you want to Just tell us anything about movies, video games, superhero stuff, comics, whatever that would be interesting to our listeners. We will most certainly read it on the podcast. We also have a website, darkdiscussions.com, where you can find us. And our RSS feed can be found anywhere podcasts are found. Just search for Dark Discussions Podcast. Also, we have a Facebook group called Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, where you can join the discussion and discuss anything related to genre. We have a lot of good topics going on there. Oddly, since the coronavirus, it's been a little more slow compared to before, when people were going to theaters and really talking about all the stuff. But we do have a lot of good conversation going on there, including the AMC stuff that Mike was talking about earlier. And there's discussions still on films that are being pushed back, as well as just general horror movies and such. All right. And what else can people find on the website?
Oh, there's a bunch of stuff they can find on the website. On the right-hand side of the front page, you'll find links to Friends of the Pod. You can check those out. At the top, you will find an article section where you can read articles written by myself as well as others. There's also an audio section with every episode of the Dark Discussions podcast and any of the spin-off podcasts ever recorded, available to download for free. So there's bound to be something that interests you there. Check that out on the front page, front center. Find a link to our Patreon page. Patreon is a service that allows you to financially contribute to your online artists. Producing this podcast is not free. We have to pay for things like server hosting, websites. We have to rent all our movies, so on and so forth, equipment failures. If you'd like to help us offset the cost of producing this show, that's how you can do it. You can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. For every $5 a month that you care to contribute, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly do an episode on. We take all these submissions from our patrons and on a quarterly basis draw one at random to do an episode on. So for more information, you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions or follow the link on the front page of darkdiscussions.com.
Yep, absolutely. And for folks who are new to this podcast, you probably already figured it out, but basically we discuss all sorts of genre films, so horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, arthouse, midnight movies, cult films, and drive-in type affair, basically trying to talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. Now, Mike, me, you, and Eric just finished up a podcast that's going on hiatus, and also there's a new, or I should say, we're going to recontinue and start up another podcast. What are those two?
Well, Wolves and Brothels and Bots just wrapped up its third season after the eighth episode of the third season of Westworld, which we ended up, if you haven't been able to pick it up, with the subtle clues that were dropped on a down note. But otherwise, you know, we did have fun for 8 weeks discussing it to one degree or another. And all 28 or 30 or so of those episodes discussing the original films as well as the three seasons of the HBO TV series are available on iTunes and Stitcher and Google Play and all the other podcast providers, as well as the Dark Discussions website. And now that that has expired, we are going to be moving on back to the podcast Cinema a la Carte, which we'll be discussing sort of random films that are not really Dark Discussions films, but are more other types of films. And I think the next one we have in the pipeline is Forbidden Planet.
Yep, that's right. That's right. So folks should start looking out for Cinema a la Carte to start reappearing on the Dark Discussions podcast feed, as well as on its own feed, which will be basically wherever podcasts are found. Eric, you also do another podcast with your buddy Dan, who actually has been a co-host or a guest host on Dark Discussions at least twice to discuss our two episodes on Lars von Trier films, I think, or at least once. Maybe it was just once,
I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
yeah. He came on to talk about Melancholia because that's a movie he really, really enjoys. He and I do a general interest podcast called the Askancy Podcast. That's spelled Askancity. You can find it wherever you got this one.
Excellent. And folks should definitely go check it out. Chrissy, you actually just released a kind of cool thing. What was that?
It is The inaugural issue of 34 Orchard, which is a literary magazine which specializes in dark, visceral literary fiction. So there's some horror, there's some urban legend, there is some toxic relationship, there's some real life horror, there's all kinds of good stuff. There's something for everybody. There's also poetry. And you can check that out at 34orchard.com. So it's the number 34 and then the word orchard together, just like an address, .com. So that's my latest baby. And plus, I have been sending out my a novel that I was working on. I decided to release it as chapbooks. So those have been going out in the mail. You know, in the last couple of weeks, and I'm doing an issue once a month. I'm releasing it until we're done, basically until I'm done with, until the book is done. So I don't know how many installments is going to be, because I'm actually not done writing the, there's a few scenes left I have to go in the actual book. So I'm going to hopefully, I'm writing the back half of it now. But the front half is done, and the front half is what's going on, is what's going out in issues. And right now I have enough for about 5 or 6 issues. So I'm guessing there'll be like 10 or 12 by the time I'm all done.
All right. Very good. Excellent. All right. So, and Abe, me, you, Barrett, and Kevin are going to be doing a book episode coming out, or we're actually going to record it next week.
Yes. Hopefully not this week, next week. we've had to push this back quite a few times, but we'll be talking about Whisper in the Dark and Lovecraft story. As I said beforehand, we had to push back because of other things that have come up, but hopefully we'll have this recorded and ready to share with everybody. While you wait for that one, you could check out other book episodes. We've done a couple on some Stephen King stories, and we've done one other Lovecraft story. So while you wait up for the next episode, please check out those and hope you enjoy.
Yep, excellent, excellent. All right, so let's give our final thoughts on 1BR. So let's start with you, Eric.
Oh, wow. Reverse order. I like this movie. I think I liked it more after talking about it with you guys. So I think I was just not prepared for what I was going to get when I went into it. I will most likely give this another watch at some point, and I do recommend it.
Excellent. Yep. Very good. For me, I would recommend it a lot. I enjoyed it the first watch. It was a really fun film and fun how we explained it earlier, not because obviously it's not fun because of what happens in the film, but it was good entertainment value. Hour and 30 minutes short. It was quick, didn't drag, didn't make really many mistakes in its plot, and a really good film. And unlike Mike, it'll probably be in my top 20 best horror films of 2020, though we'll see as it goes. But so far, I'm enjoying this year completely. Even with the theaters closed, there's been a hell of a lot of good films, in my opinion, that are genre related. Mike?
Yeah, I like this a lot. As you just said, it's going to end up being in my top 20, certainly, and almost certainly in my top 10. Really love the I love the script. I think it was a smart script. It wasn't a complicated script. It was simple, but it was effective. The big questions I would have had about it, they pretty much answered, in terms of like, well, why didn't anybody look for her and so on and so forth? And why is it that, nobody's taken notice, this community and all that? I think if you're patient, those questions end up being answered. And there really aren't a lot of questions that popped up anyway, because they answered them proactively, especially that part about nailing in the hands. That's going to be useful in the future, I'm sure. So, I highly recommend it. Go check it out as soon as you can.
Yeah, very good. Abe.
This was an interesting film. May not be my favorite of this for this year, but I thought it was well shot. The performance was really strong, especially our lead actress. Hopefully, Mrs. Bloom will get more interesting roles down the road and build up a repertoire for herself. I think it's going to. depending how, you know, depending on the viewer, you know, how much you might get enjoy the watch, it's going to vary because it's not going to work for everybody. But it does, I think, from my viewpoint, do a lot pretty damn good. It's available on Amazon to rent. So if you want to check it out, it's there. And yeah, if you ever get a chance to watch it and you follow us, give us your thoughts and share how you feel about the film yourself.
All right, very good. Chrissy.
I really found this film an entertaining ride. I really liked it. I think it had a lot of nice twists. I thought the acting was good. I thought the story was well built and pretty good. Yeah, recommend. I think it's definitely worth the rental price.
Yep, very good. All right. So once again, this is technically it's a 2019 film because it did the festivals, but it was released everywhere in 2020. So it's technically a 2020 film for the majority of us, except for Jason Lloyd. It was directed by...
Actually, there's no festivals this year, so maybe he's changed his policy.
Yes, that's true. That's a good point, yes. So either way, the film was directed by David Marmor and written by him as well, and basically his first real big thing. Starred Nicole Bride and Bloom, basically in her first really big thing, and had a pretty decent supporting cast of character actors such as Taylor Nichols and maybe Giles Mathey, who also is young enough that he could possibly break out too, because he's done some fairly important roles on television shows. But either way, it's available anywhere you can rent or purchase VOD films. I don't know about disc, but I haven't bothered looking at that, but I'm sure it would be there eventually, if not already. And with all that, I guess, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in and listening to us talk about 1BR. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.
There's a certain sound always follows me around. When you're close to me, you will hear it. It's the sound that love. Because you're